going to call the Human Services Division to order for Friday, April 12th. We have a very long agenda today, but we are not anticipating having to hold that hearing tomorrow, so that's the trade-off. There's donuts and whatnot for members and staff, and we will probably take a little recess. We're going to provide pizza for members sometime around 11, 11:30, something like that. Members and staff, give people a little rest to stretch and whatnot. The reminder I always give, we are the finance division. Most of these bills that have significant policy ramifications have been heard in the policy divisions. And so if we can stick to the finance aspects of this, we will be able to move much more efficiently through our agenda. And if testifiers can limit their testimony to between 2 and 3 minutes, that will help us a great deal and will be much appreciated by all of the members around the table. With that, we are going to start with Senator Marty and Senate File 1450. Welcome to the committee, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 1450 would allow counties to discontinue trying to collect child support if the children on the order are all over 18 and if the arrearage is under $500 or it's considered unenforceable by the public authority because either the person has zero income or other things. They have no loss of revenue to the county because these are uncollectible. If the person who's been benefiting from it or would be benefiting from the collection thinks they have a chance of it, they will keep the case open. They're allowed to reopen the case at any time. In Ramsey County, they think it will save them one full-time person, a couple of them in Hennepin County, and the only fiscal note is programming costs and some updating documents that Ramsey County will volunteer to do for them. And in ongoing costs, we don't know where it's coming from because these are unenforceable child support orders. Mr. Chair, I have Mark Ponsole from the Ramsey County Attorney's Office to speak to the bill.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Mark Ponsole, P-O-N-S-O-L-L-E. I am an assistant Ramsey County attorney and the Human Services Division Director in the County Attorney's Office in Ramsey County. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee Senator Marty. The only thing I would just like to add is Ramsey County would volunteer to handle all the documents and the policy documents. Ramsey County doesn't program or maintain the PRISM system, so just to clarify the programming, we wouldn't be able to do. Obviously, that would be a state issue. Rather than try to go into any particular details, I'd be just more than willing to answer any questions you have in the interest of time.
Thank you, Mr. Ponsell. You know, as I look through it, so, Senator Marty, I understand you to say you're not sure where the ongoing costs associated with this come from yet. I mean, I see this fiscal note was just completed yesterday, so it doesn't give us a lot of time to review that, but we can maybe continue to work on it and try to figure out what that is. And
Mr. Chair, it says $7,241 ongoing cost. I guess that's required maintenance of the change in the programming. I don't know why there'd be a cost to that, but again, as Mr. Ponsole said, Ramsey County is willing to update the documents for them for the state, which would mean the only cost is the programming. And it is a cost, but again, the counties, he can save one full-time equivalent in Ramsey County Attorney's Office and Hennepin County. I think they believe it would be twice that big. So it is a savings to the counties because these are unenforceable. They're just wasting time trying to collect things when the child's already grown and there's no income available or it's very small amounts and they're just not collecting the money. If there's any evidence that the obligor gets a job or has income at any time, they can reopen the case, so there's no real risk of losing revenue.
Okay. Yes, and in the fiscal note, it references one-time costs, and then they continue. But, I mean, I guess that $7,000 isn't – I mean, there's also the MFIP costs that I'm trying to reconcile here that wind up a general fund cost – to the state of in the ballpark of $120,000 per year.
Mr. Chair, Ponsell. I might try to address that. I also have just received the fiscal note, but given that I've been working in the program, I've attempted to try to absorb fairly quick. One of the issues is I know the state in preparing the note looked at the issue of how many cases that have not paid in 3 years. They just took an example of, let's say, 3 years, like say, let's say 2007 to 2010, no payment 3 years, then from 2010 onward were there payments. And some of those cases with no payments in 3 years did have payments, and I think that's what they're referring to. However, the way the counties would close these cases is the first cut is, has there been payment for 3 years? If there's no payment for 3 years, then we evaluate the case to see what tools have we used, what do we know about the person, what is the likelihood that they'll be able to pay in the future, what is their past been looking like, have they been incarcerated, have they been homeless for years. We'd look at more than just the 3 years to determine whether we can actually, in the specific case, collect. If we determine a specific case that we feel we can collect, we will keep the case open even if there's been no payment for 3 years. So as in most fiscal notes, it's a guesstimate as to what the future would look like. But what I don't think it fully takes into consideration is that the counties intend to analyze each case with our background and expertise to determine whether the likelihood is we can collect it, very similar to any business would do.
Okay. Yeah, I see in the fiscal note it says that PRISM data shows that 2% of arrears are from cases that haven't had any payments and 3%, but you believe at the county level you can identify those 2%, that
yes.
2% and keep it on the books. So we'll keep working on that. Any other questions of members? Senator Benson.
Just really briefly, we didn't hear this in policy. The ability for a case to continually be reopened, was there any thought given to that there should be a time certain when we're not going to dig this up anymore? And I'm not going to dig in and try to figure out what that number should be, but I would like to know if there was any thought to that.
Mr. Ponsell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, what we would do is if we learn there was information that would allow us to collect the underlying debt by someone providing it to us or us finding it on our own, we would then open the case. But we wouldn't open and close the case without that kind of additional information. So we'd close it if we thought it was uncollectible, and then if we thought we could collect it for whatever reason, then we would open it. The one key here is that the underlying debt, the fact we close a case, the underlying debt does not go away. It is still there. So we can go back and collect on it if we learn information.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that answered your question, Senator Benson. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
Any other questions of members? Senator
Marty. Mr. Chair, one more point. Again, and I'm sorry, I missed that line, which is the big line here. But it is that is revenue that the state thinks they might be losing. The counties don't believe they're losing it. They're not getting it. It's not just 3 years have passed. And if they do find a chance to collect something, they can go back and collect it anyway. I think the savings to the counties are such and that money, that line seems to me should be a zero for the state. It's not a loss of revenue because they're not collecting it and they're not going to collect it.
Okay. Well, we can continue to work with DHS on those estimates and see if we can't craft some language around it, and if we can, and try to accommodate those costs and get them down, it makes it much easier to incorporate, but those conversations can continue. Any other questions of members? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If this bill was not heard in policy committee, if that is correct, do we have a procedural issue here then with deadlines?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Martin.
The bill was heard in Judiciary Committee, which is
yes.
Where I believe it belongs, which is where I think it should
okay,
have been.
Okay, just was
right.
Not heard in HHS
right.
Policy.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's the Judiciary Policy, but it's the HHS Finance is where it winds up. So any other questions of members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience care to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 1450? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves Senate File 1450 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Martin.
Members of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. You know, we have one other quick one. I believe Senator Miller is in the room and has the Region 10 Quality Assurance, Senate File 941. Then we'll probably go to Senate File 1034, the Omnibus HHS for the Healthcare Administration proposals only, because DHS staff that are going to cover that need to get over to the other body to work with them as well. With that, Senator Miller, welcome to the committee, Senate File 941.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you. Today we have Senate File 941 in front of us. This has to do with the quality assurance system and Region 10 quality assurance. We were in the HHS policy committee last week or the week before. I'm happy to go through the bill. I'm not sure if there is a fiscal implication. I believe the fiscal note came back at zero, but I'm happy to run through the bill quickly if that's how you'd like me to proceed.
Senator Miller, why don't you just give us a quick review of what the bill does? It looks like it's the Region 10 quality assurance that's existed for some time, and it looks like it continues it. Is that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So what we're doing is right now DHS is moving toward developing a new state quality management system, and they're going to utilize the Region 10 approach or something very similar to that. So what we're doing is we're extending the date. In current law, there's a sunset date of June 30th, 2014 for Region 10 quality assurance. We delete the sunset date in order for Region 10 quality assurance to operate until the state system is operational. There's one more thing. We also allow in Section 7, line 4.21, I'm sorry, Section 8, line 5.10, it provides language to allow the Region 10 stakeholder membership criteria to be extended another 2 years. Under current law, this is a two-year term, but since the new system is not in place, we're asking for that to be extended another 2 years. And the other thing that we do, Section 5, line 3.18, there's a voluntary stipend, or there's a stipend right now for some members to receive if they're not currently working for a provider, county, or state agency, if they're being paid by their employer. Some of the team members want to do this on a voluntary basis and not receive a stipend, so we just change the language to basically say that they may, if they are eligible for that stipend, they may receive it if they want to.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
We don't have a fiscal note?
I have an email from DHS which confirms there is no fiscal cost to the continuation of this program. I was going to ask somebody from DHS to come up and confirm that on the record if they would. And with that, we do have a long history with Region 10 quality assurance, and I think there's broad support for that. Is somebody from DHS able to confirm that there's no fiscal cost to Senate File 941 and the continuation of the Region 10 quality assurance? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office at the Department of Human Services, in which the licensing division is located, and we did review this bill, and there is no fiscal note. No
Thank
cost,
you.
I should say.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I do have Steve Larson here who may want to just say a few words as well.
Mr. Larson, do you wish to say a few words?
Mr. Chair, Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions of members? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Since there is no fiscal note, it does have to be rolled over? Over into your bill?
Or I was just working on that in my head. I don't know where it is in the other body. I was thinking I would dual track this that if it does run into trouble in the other body, we could include it in the omnibus bill. But if the other body is moving it separate, Senator Miller, do you know what the progress of this in the House is?
Allow Mr. Larson to provide that update.
Mr. Larson?
Mr. Chair, as soon as we're done here, we're going over with an amendment to try to include it in the House omnibus, Health and Human Services omnibus bill.
Okay.
I'll make that motion to dual track.
Sure. Okay. First, let me ask, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 941? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 941 be dual tracked, that is recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance, but that it also be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services omnibus bill. on that motion. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Chair and members.
Yep. Okay, we're going to go to Senate File 1034 and go over the health care administration portions of the governor's budget.
Give you a little more room today.
Madam Chair, members will get another of the DHS indexes that'll help us understand which proposals we're going to cover today. The first column of numbers there is where you will find the proposals in the governor's change pages. You will find for Senator Kiffmeyer the unofficial engrossment page actually listed there, as well as the article and section. In the unofficial engrossment. So this should help members track and find the language that we're talking about. And with that, I'll turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Lights.
Commissioner Lights, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The first item that we will be covering this morning will be it's change page number 9, pages 224 through 227 in the unofficial engrossment. And this is continuation of coverage for emergency medical assistance for cancer and dialysis. This was an item it's unchanged from the governor's original proposal. This is in 2012, the legislature restored coverage of EMA for cancer and dialysis treatments, but put a sunset in of June 30th, 2012. This proposal removes that sunset and continues that coverage permanently.
Mr. Lights, can you please introduce yourself for the record?
Madam Chair and members, Scott Lights, Assistant Commissioner from DHS.
How could I forget that?
Do members have any questions?
Yes, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner, is it good to just continue coverage indefinitely? I mean, there was a limit put on it for a reason, and we are taking off the sunset date.
Commissioner Lights.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, you know, originally there was one-time funding that allowed the coverage to continue for a year. I think from the administration's perspective, this coverage is something that we would want permanently added to the benefit set for EMA. It's coverage for pretty critical conditions that we just think is important to have as part of the base coverage package under EMA.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we're back in healthcare world, so help me understand the EMA population. What is their demographic?
Commissioner Lights.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the EMA population is a population that is ineligible for certain services under the medical assistance program, and will be a population that will also be ineligible for some of coverage under the Affordable Care Act and the expansions there. So these are folks who are here. They're not here in a documented status, and so the coverage that covers them really provides base levels of services to ensure that they're able to get services. It's a federal program. It's limited in scope, and so it's really scoped towards those folks who have emergent medical conditions to ensure that they get that coverage.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lights, could you clarify the lack of documented status, and if this is a federal program, why aren't the feds paying for it?
Commissioner Lights.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, what I mean by that, these are folks who are not in the country on having documentation or documented status. Most of them are largely it's a metropolitan area. The vast majority of these folks are in the metropolitan area, Twin Cities, and it is a program that's federally covered, but it's covered in the same way that we cover all of our programs, where there's a cost to the state and a cost to the federal government, where the costs are split between the two.
Commissioner Lights.
Madam Chair, the next item is change page 11, and this is a PMAP Merck investment. This is also unchanged from the governor's original budget. What this does is to restore funding for the Medical Education and Research Cost Fund to levels that were in place in fiscal year 11. There were some changes made in the budget in 2011 that reduced funding for medical education. This restores that funding to its fiscal year 11 level. The program provides grants to healthcare organizations who train medical students, and so it's a piece of legislation that's been in place for a number of years that we feel, with the expansion of individuals coming into the system over the next several years, it'll be important that we have processes and funding in place to ensure that we have trained medical professionals to work with them. So this program restores that funding.
Commissioner Lightson, I do have a bill on Merck upcoming later today. Can you clarify, is this the first time it's ever been cut, Merck funding?
Madam Chair, there have been a number of reductions to the Merck Fund over time. It is a program that originally was partially state-funded. This is the portion that we're dealing with within the DHS budget is really the PMAP carve-out, where the money that is included in the PMAP rates for medical education are removed from those rates and paid directly to the teaching hospitals to ensure that money flows directly to those hospitals. I don't have the exact history of all the reductions, but it has been reduced over time somewhat. This is probably the largest reduction, though, that has occurred in the program since its inception.
Thank you.
The next
Madam
item,
Chair,
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen. I'm sorry, I just have to ask this question. Assistant Commissioner, is there a breakdown between what some of the rural hospitals, is there a breakdown on hospitals and rural versus metro, or is it just strictly to a teaching hospital?
Commissioner Lights.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it goes to for a variety of training institutions. Some are rural, some are metro. We can get that breakdown to the committee, but it does include, I think there has been an emphasis over time in ensuring that we not only make sure that there's money in urban areas, but also that we have trained professionals, particularly in the primary care area and rural areas. And I might also add that the funding for the program doesn't flow strictly for the training of physicians. It also flows for training of other types of professionals who serve in the healthcare area, advanced practice nurses, dentists, and others. So we think it's been wisely targeted in a variety of those areas over time. But we'll make sure the committee gets that breakdown.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps this will be answered in a later bill. We had some problems with distribution of Merck funds. Does this do anything to reform how those funds were being distributed?
Commissioner Lights.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, when you say a problem with the distribution, do you mean like literally a mechanical problem of getting the dollars out?
No, I apologize for not being clear. I'm trying to recall. We were sitting in the basement of the state office building because Abler had the gavel, and we were talking about how there was one hospital that had one student and had just gotten this huge proportion of the Merck money, than other hospitals who had much more teaching going on were getting smaller portions. Is there any reform in this piece?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, thanks for the clarification. I understand what you're referring to now. And I think what you're referring to is the fact that the money that is distributed under the Merck Fund is the formula that distributes that money is based on solely on Medicaid volume at each facility. And then, in fact, it looks at whether they're what the top 20% of Medicaid providers are and what the lower 20% of those in the distribution. It actually redistributes dollars from the lower to the higher. So it gives a lot of emphasis on the Medicaid volume. Now, part of that's appropriate because these are Medicaid dollars. And so the federal government has insisted over time that the dollars flow for Medicaid services. And DHS feels that's important, too. That said, we do know that there have been some situations like the one you referenced where in some situations a very small amount of teaching is occurring, but because the institution may have a very large Medicaid volume, they get a very large payment for not very much teaching. We aren't including specifically a formula change within the governor's budget. That said, We do strongly feel that the discussion needs to occur this session around how the dollars should be distributed, and I think we'll be wanting to work with the committees and the stakeholder groups around how we can best reform that formula, because I do think we do believe that a couple things need to occur. One is that we need to make sure that there is appropriate focus on primary care, particularly in rural areas of the state. And secondly, I think that some of the situations like you referenced are ones that we'd like to try to address moving forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
The next item, Madam Chair, is change page 12, which is the MA rate increase for targeted service categories. This is a proposal that was included in the governor's original budget. It's been revised a little bit. It includes the goal of this original item was really to ensure that, again, similarly as we've talked about Merck, as we move forward with expanding and having more people enrolled in our medical assistance program, that we have sufficient rates being paid to providers. And we haven't really made rate increases in this program for any number of years. And what this proposal does is to start to try to remedy this. It doesn't do it all in one fell swoop, but I think we have a very good start on what we're trying to accomplish here. Most of these increases to inpatient hospitals for services such as medical equipment, dialysis, lab services, and public health nursing, outpatient hospital services, and physician and professional services for things like primary care, chiropractic, audiology, and other things. Our fee-for-service rate increases in the budget item. There is an increase in dental rates as well included in the item. That would apply to both fee-for-service and to managed care, and then some increases that would apply to clinic-based family planning services as well. So that is the item. The proposal has a cost of about $28 million over the biennium. The next item, Madam Chair, is change page 16. This was an item that was included in the governor's original budget. It's unchanged from that original proposal. This proposal moves all claims for diabetic test strips to our pharmacy benefit. All the claims will be processed at the point of sale, which provides some additional opportunities to for program integrity and utilization management. We really don't anticipate this is going to have a huge disruption for people, but about 90% of our current claims for test strips are filled through that channel. This just moves the remainder of those to that channel. And what this item does in totality is to produce a modest savings, but not thoroughly insignificant, of about $500,000 over the biennium by making this change. Next item is on page 17 of the change pages. What this does is really make a change to, again, for some modest savings, a change to how we pay for drugs. And what it really does is to ensure that the same drug is paid at the same rate regardless of the setting in which it occurs. We have a situation now where we pay slightly differently depending on whether a drug is administered in a clinic or whether it's administered in a an outpatient drug or an inpatient setting. So what this does is to sort of parallel those two things so that we're not paying different prices depending on the setting for the same drug. It's just a consistent policy application. Produces, as I said, a modest savings of around $47,000 in the biennium. Next item, Madam Chair, is on page 18 of the change pages. This, again, is an unchanged proposal from the governor's original budget. This corrects the rate that we applied for services that are provided in our child and teen checkup program. As part of that, vaccines are administered. Some of those vaccines are provided through the Vaccines for Kids program. That's a program where the vaccines are procured at no cost to the provider. We did discover in our system that there had been some billing for drugs that had been procured at for free. And so when we rolled up the rate for child and teen checkup, it includes it's a sort of a bundled rate that includes costs for a variety of services. The costs associated with the vaccines was included in that. What this does, since those drugs did not cost any money to be procured, we are removing the cost of the vaccine, or the billing for those vaccines from the bundled rate. And that's what this item does. Madam Chair, the next item is on page 128 of the change pages. This is a new item. This item expands the definition of durable medical equipment to allow for electronic tablets and related software to be used as augmentative communication devices. The devices that we now purchase through durable medical equipment providers for people who require some augmentative communication device cost around $4,700. Allowing for use of tablet computers or tablet processors is about $1,000, so it produces a per-unit savings of around $3,700 on average. We just think the way that the world is evolving, this is just a prudent way to allow for a less costly alternative for people. We buy about 165 of these devices over the course of the last 3 years. We anticipate sort of ramping in that we'll convert as people change from their current device to the tablet as an option, 10 to 12 annually. And so this produces a modest savings of around $22,000 over the biennium.
Any questions? Commissioner?
The next item is on page 130, and this is a primary care rate increase. The Affordable Care Act it provides funding to states to increase the rates for certain primary care providers for calendar years 2013 and 2014. I think this was a recognition that there would be additional individuals coming into the healthcare system and that primary care was going to be a important part of that. The rate increase is covered fully by the federal government, so it's a 100% federally funded rate increase. And the rates are increased to either the corresponding Medicare rate for the calendar year or the Medicare rate used in 2009, whichever was lower. And basically, the importance of that is that Medicaid typically pays below Medicare for services. And so what this does is increase the Medicaid rate up to Medicare services for those Medicare rates for those primary care services. As I mentioned, the federal government is covering 100% of this rate increase. The cost that's being carried in the governor's budget is just the system cost related to our implementation of that rate increase.
We get all $8,000.
Senator Benson?
Chair. Commissioner Leitz, could the department eat $8,000? We spend more on the paper.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, it is indeed a modest cost.
Commissioner?
The next item, I think we've covered 135.
We haven't done it.
No, that's right. We did the other items. The next item, Madam Chair, is on page 135. And this is the Minnesota Care Program continuation. This is a new proposal from the governor's budget. You'll recall that in the governor's original budget, we set aside a placeholder in the budget for continuation of the Minnesota Care Program. At the time the governor's budget came out, we did not have clarity from the federal government around what the rules would be for the basic health plan funding, and we were really viewing that as the vehicle by which we could fund and continue to fund the Minnesota Care Program. What this proposal does is to, we have received since that time clarity around what the funding will look like from the federal government. What they've indicated is that two things to us. One is that starting in 2015, states will have the opportunity to access basic health plan funding to operate programs such as Minnesota Care. That means for 2014, there won't be basic health plan funding available. But what we've also been able to work with the federal government on gaining an understanding of is under the Affordable Care Act, all state waivers, such as the one that we operate the current Minnesota Care program, expire as of December 31st, 2013. We have been working with the feds since that time, have received an indication that they will extend our waiver through 2014 in preparation for us receiving basic health plan funding starting in 2015. That does require us to fund a Minnesota Care at a 50% match rate as opposed to a much lower match rate that we'll be receiving under basic health plan funding, but it does allow us to continue to get federal funding for this. There's a number of changes that we'll be making to Minnesota Care to come into alignment in preparation for the program expanding in under BHP in 2015. A couple of things I'll just mention here. We, under the program, will eliminate the $10,000 cap on inpatient hospital services in Minnesota Care. That would be required, but it's also, we feel, just a good policy thing to do to get rid of that cap. We'll be eliminating the asset test in Minnesota Care, converting our income counting methodology to the modified adjusted gross income or MAGI methodology, and then modify some of the eligibility requirements by eliminating the program's current 4-month and 18-month renewal barriers. There's barriers that are put in place that have been put in place over time, and so those are eliminated as well as part of this proposal. One of the changes, in addition to the sort of aligning with where the pieces are on the Affordable Care Act from a coverage perspective, we're further proposing to set the upper income limit for the program at 200% of the federal poverty guidelines starting in January of 2014. Individuals above that level will be eligible to receive advanced premium tax credits through the MNSURE. And this proposal also repeals the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program, which was put in place by the 2012 legislature that required, or 2011 legislature rather, that required individuals who were enrolled in Minnesota Care between 200 and 250 of poverty to transition into this Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program. Those individuals will now also be moving to the MNSURE.
Senator Rosen. Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner, is this fiscal note based off the first engrossment of Senate File 184?
Commissioner Lights? Senator Lurie?
The answer to that is no, but we do have Senate File 184 on our agenda today as well, and so we'll cover that. This is the governor's proposal for the new Minnesota Care with BHP funding. I have worked on 184 as well and have some significant changes, and we'll get the fiscal note for that as well. And probably we'll need significant changes before the delete everything comes on Monday as well. So we'll keep working on it.
Senator Benson.
And Mr. Lights, elimination of the asset test. I'm trying to track things. The ACA says you can't use an asset test for people who are trying to qualify for programs under MAGI, but Minnesota Care is kind of related, but not necessarily included. So is this the governor of the state of Minnesota saying we're not going to have an asset test for Minnesota Care, or do you think this is federal conformity?
Commissioner Lights?
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, we will be operating the program under an 1115 medical assistance waiver, and so we really viewed this as coming into compliance with what the requirements would be for that program starting in 2014. So it'll be with the adoption of the MAGI methodology as well as the asset test piece, since we'll still be operating the program at that point as a Medicaid program, that alignment we felt was necessary.
Okay, and Madam Chair, Mr. Lights, I just have a concern because we were not tracking income well on Minnesota Care, so there's some program integrity issues, and now we're eliminating an asset test. altogether, and perhaps 10,000 and 20,000 were too low. I get that. But if somebody hits a hard spot, they might have a lot of other assets available. Based on income view only, they'd qualify for a program and they might have other resources. And so I am concerned about this. We might be spending more of the state's dollars than we actually need to because we're trying to do federal conformity where it's not explicitly necessary at this point. And so I think as we're looking to tighten things up, we might want to review this and put in some sort of asset review for this program because, you know, at some point we're going to run out of money and we have to ask people to put in a little more of their assets on some of these programs.
Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, you know, one issue with that, I mean, I do think that because we're running it under an 1115 waiver, it probably is a federal requirement. But beyond that, as we try to build one streamlined system and one streamlined application portal under the MAGI standard to introduce for this band of income levels another set of tests would really overcomplicate things and make it much more administratively burdensome. And I recognize the OLA report that we got a couple, 2-3 weeks ago, recognizing historic deficiencies in our tracking of income. But under the new MAGI, Modified Adjusted Gross Income standard, there are significant systems enhancements to really get on top of our ability to make sure that we're doing accurate assessments of individuals' proper eligibility with the rollout of Minsure. And so to introduce those extra complexities probably would not give us the return on investment that we're looking for if we really work to just make this MAGI standard as good as it can be and accept that that, especially when coupled with the fact that it probably really is federal conformity as well. But it is a good discussion point, and happy to continue to work on it, but need to recognize the entirety of the major systems reforms that we're undertaking here.
And Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, I recognize that we are making a fundamental transformation. I can just see down the line where somebody has significant, not their first home assets, but they've had now a dip in income. They qualify for one of these programs, and it just looks like we're helping out people that maybe could help themselves. And so we need to be aware that when we're removing asset tests, we are opening up to repeat some of the behaviors that got called out in the OLA report, maybe under a different category, but there were questionable behaviors about people accessing things that they didn't really need.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, the final item is change page 139. And this is the Minnesota Care Share of the Minsure funding. This is a new item in the governor's budget. Enrollees who will be enrolling into Minnesota Care will be having their eligibility determination done through the exchange. And so the state, through the public program folks who are enrolling into programs through the exchange that are publicly run, those costs are cost allocated back to the Medicaid or Minnesota Care program. And so what this item does is really cover the costs that are allocated back from the exchange for the purposes of covering the costs related to enrollment of Minnesota Care individuals. And that's what's captured in this item.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Leitz, and we had talked about the Health Care Access Fund. I think Senator Sharon brought it up at one point. And we talked about this item being a subtraction, and Senator Lurie gave us a couple of other examples of things in the budget that would be a subtraction from the Health Care Access Fund. But we didn't get a full reconciliation, and it's because Senator Lurie didn't have all the details. When are we going to see a full reconciliation of everything coming out of the Health Care Access Fund and where it's going?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, that's something the department is working on. I think we will have that very shortly for you. I don't have a specific timeline, but it is something that we're working very quickly to get for you.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Leitz, before we vote the omnibus bill out of this committee, will we have a reconciliation?
Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, we will do our level best to make sure that you do. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what the timing is exactly for your voting out of the committee, so.
Senator Lurie?
I'm just one vote on the committee. I guess I need to get several more before I can have any certainty that we get out of here. You know, the plan is to have the delete everything that will be to Senate File 1034 rolled out on Monday morning. I think we sent out a notice yesterday indicating, and maybe this is a good time to just give everybody, the public members, a plan. We're hoping to do kind of a walkthrough of the spreadsheet Monday morning. We have session. We'll break for session. We'll take some members' questions after session and some public testimony as much as, you know, we have time for. We'll come back on Tuesday morning, take some more public testimony, additional questions from members. Tuesday afternoon, going into the evening, it would be our intention to start considering amendments, discussing them, adopting whatever makes sense and is the will of the committee, and hopefully, probably late on Tuesday, voting on this bill, trying to get it out of committee with the intent of being in full finance on Thursday of next week. That is the schedule that we're anticipating and hoping to work collaboratively toward achieving. So Tuesday evening would be our target for getting out of this committee. And I do think we're not going to try to hide the ball on what the Healthcare Access Fund is doing. I think that whether we have the exact tracking document that says everything, I think it'll be pretty obvious what's happening with the Healthcare Access Fund.
Thank you. And
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, Commissioner Leitz, it had just been a question very early on because there was a reserve component. Senator Rosen raised it. Senator Sharon has raised it. It's not a surprise that people are going to want to see where that money is going, and I know you will do your best, but it gives us a lot more comfort if we can just see it, then we don't have to wonder. And so it's important. I know you have other fiscal notes to do, and you're going to be helping Senator Lurie over the weekend to get this thing buttoned up. But it's been out there as a known issue for quite a while.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Any other questions from members? At this point, I think we'll open it up for any other testimony from any members of the audience here. Good morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Fatima Hajitaki on behalf of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. Immigrant Law Center's clients are low-income immigrants and refugees. Last year, the center worked with about 4,600 clients from about 98 countries. We strongly support the governor's efforts to provide additional services for persons with EMA who are in need of dialysis and chemotherapy, which was discussed earlier. We've also been working with members of the Safety Net Coalition on Senate File 1099 to expand coverage to include services that would prevent conditions from becoming emergencies and follow-up care provided in community, residential, and outpatient settings after discharge from an ER to prevent reoccurrence of a medical emergency. The Immigrant Law Center usually deals mostly with immigration law, but became involved in the intersection of healthcare services and its impact on non-citizens last year with the changes to the EMA statute. Immigrant Law Center represented several immigrants who were impacted when their life-saving care was either terminated or threatened to be terminated. The nature of immigration law is extremely complex and fluid. While working with almost 50 clients, the Immigrant Law Center in about one-fourth of the cases was able to change status either for permanent residents on what is called a green card to citizenship or those on undocumented status to have a more permanent status, and this allows them to access different services that are out there. In our experience, immigrants not only fear government, but also government care. But when they get sick and are in dire need of services, they do end up in the emergency room to get medical assistance. To help reduce costs of uncompensated care and also enable non-citizens to access the exchange, where Immigrant Law Center strongly recommends funding. There was an element number 31 of the Minnesota Healthcare Task Report. The report's name was Roadmap to a Healthier Minnesota, to create a referral process to connect people who are not eligible for Medicaid or premium tax credits to low-cost health services and legal services for immigration assistance. That's all I have. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Hajitaki, for your testimony. Are there any questions from members? Thank you again. Are there any other testifiers that would like to come up at this time?
Yep.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Leslie Martin, and I'm a member of Take Action Minnesota. We support the governor's Minnesota care priorities, and I'm testifying in support of specific priorities because I believe that Minnesota care needs to be improved and preserved. Having been on Minnesota care, I know firsthand how vital this health care program is. In the late 1990s, I survived cancer twice. In 2009, after rapid weight loss, I was diagnosed with something called gastroparesis. It sounds horrible, but what it means is that part of my stomach is paralyzed. The cause is unknown. Then, after experiencing debilitating pain and overwhelming fatigue, I learned that I also now have fibromyalgia. And recently, I developed a chronic autoimmune skin disease that kept me bedridden for a while. Fortunately, it is now in remission. I didn't ask for any of these maladies, nor did I do anything to cause them. But some days, all I can do is work and sleep. Like most people, we had health insurance through an employer. In our case, my husband's employer. But after his longtime job was eliminated and our COBRA ran out, we had nowhere to turn. We couldn't afford a private insurance plan, and the two part-time jobs that I have, in addition to my professional writing and editing, did not offer coverage. As a result, we were uninsured for months until we qualified for Minnesota Care. This program was a lifesaver for our family, giving us access to the needed care and medications that we otherwise would not have been able to afford. I believe that it is essential to expand income eligibility to cover a wider income range of people. I'm sorry, I'm messing up here a little nervous. But I can tell you why this is important. After no luck in his job search, my husband took a job at a coffee shop, earning less than $10 an hour. Now that we have insurance through his employer, my medications alone cost $2,000 a year. Under Minnesota Care, it was $200. This is a huge financial burden for us. $2,000 for medications alone is a lot of money for the working poor. Because of my conditions, I can't choose to go without insurance, but the expensive rates of the private market and the current income limits of Minnesota Care eligibility put us in a huge financial bind. Lastly, I ask that you support making Minnesota Care premiums more affordable so that people on the program can actually build enough financial stability to be independent of the program. Thank you for listening today. I hope that you will support the Minnesota Care program and do what you can to make it more affordable. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martin, for your testimony. Members, questions? Seeing none, is there any other testifiers that like to proceed? Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for this opportunity to address you today. My name is John Andrews. I'm a pediatrician, and I'm the Associate Dean for Graduate Medical Education at the University of Minnesota. I'm joined today by Dr. Tim Capecchi, who's a second-year resident in one of our training programs, and I'll let him introduce himself more fully when he has an opportunity to speak. We're here today to voice our support for Governor Dayton's bill that includes restoration of MRC funds to the Health and Human Services budget. And I'd like to make three points. I want to make the point that Minnesota needs more doctors, that the best way to increase the supply of doctors in the state of Minnesota is to train those physicians here, and to make the point that MRC funds are critical to maintaining our current capacity to train physicians, let alone grow that capacity. We're under pressure right now due to a looming physician shortage. This is due to increased demand for physician services. Some of that is related to a growing and aging population, but it's also related to the Affordable Care Act and the increased access to care that that's going to create for people who might not previously have that access to care. That pressure is countered by the fact that in the state of Minnesota, nearly 50% of our physicians are over the age of 55, and in the next 10 to 15 years, many of those physicians will retire, and that creates a demand for replacement of their effort. Nationally, the AAMC, the American Association of Medical Colleges, estimates that there will be a shortage of 90,000 physicians in the next 10 years. In the state of Minnesota, we estimate that number to be 2,000 physicians in the next 10 years. We know that the best way to increase the physician supply in the state of Minnesota is to train those physicians in the state of Minnesota. I'm the director of all of the residency and fellowship programs at the University of Minnesota. We currently have over 900 trainees working in hospitals throughout the state of Minnesota, half of those in primary care disciplines. And we know that when they graduate, roughly two-thirds of those physicians will continue to live and practice in the state of Minnesota. Our ability to train those physicians, though, is capped by standards that were set by the federal government in the 1997 Balanced Budget Act. We still adhere to caps that were set then and funding levels that were set then. States recognizing this have applied Medicaid dollars to increase the capacity to train physicians, and Minnesota is among those through its MRC fund. In the last biennium, when the MRC funds were cut, there was an immediate and direct impact on our ability to train health professionals. I personally heard from one of our affiliate hospitals that they would provide training to two fewer trainees immediately in light of those MRC cuts. We have a long history of training some of the best and brightest young physicians in the country, and importantly in retaining them to serve the needs of the citizens of Minnesota. I want to make the point that restoration of MRC funds is necessary just to maintain our current capacity when external forces suggest we should be training more physicians. So I'm here to urge you to restore this vital support to the training of health professionals in Minnesota hospitals. At a time when we're taking steps to increase access to health care, we need to ensure there's an adequate number of physicians to provide this service. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Andrews and Dr. Capecchi. Please proceed with
your testimony. Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is Tim Capecchi. I'm a medical resident at the University of Minnesota in both pediatrics and internal medicine. I'd just like to share my own story of how MRC funding and graduate medical education has impacted my decision to come to Minnesota and to stay in Minnesota for my medical training. I grew up in South St. Paul, went to high school in Minneapolis, and then I moved out of state for college and went to New York for medical college. In my fourth year of medical school, I came back to Minnesota and did an away rotation and saw the education that the residents were receiving was far superior to anything that I had been receiving in New York. So that was a huge part of my decision to come back to Minnesota. And every day I see we have numerous reports, conferences every day. We have quality improvement projects, and where we learn how to impact our patients and give back and impact the community. We have advocacy days in which we come to the Capitol. I was just here for Pediatrician's Day at the Capitol. And numerous educational experiences, which are in part funded by MRC. And I'm very grateful for this opportunity to train in Minnesota, where I hope to make a great impact.
Thank you, Dr. Kopecky. Any questions from members? Thank you again, you both, for testifying on behalf of Merck. Do we have any other testifiers? Proceed to the table. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Will Nicholson. I am a family doctor. I grew up here in Minnesota, and I practice at St. John's Hospital in Maplewood. I'm also an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota and former director of the Preparation for Residency Program, which I'll mention a little bit later. I'm here representing the Minnesota Medical Association. We represent about 10,000 physicians and physicians in training in the state, and I wanted to be present to express my strong support for the Medical Education Research Cost Program in its entirety. You'll soon discuss SF 1481, which is a very important component of that program, and we applaud it and the governor's budget, which further proposes to reinstate broader Merck funding, which, as you know, was cut in 2011. I have to echo Dr. John Andrews' sentiment that in the face of a physician shortage in the state, we hope to see soon an expansion of funding for residency training. As you know, Merck funding provides much-needed assistance for clinical sites that are willing to train residents in order to offset some of the additional costs that they incur by doing so. It's very expensive for hospitals and clinics to provide this training, especially in the current climate where revenue streams can't be counted on. There's huge pressure on efficiency, and hospitals and clinics are not ever quite sure where they're going to be making money 1 year to the next. The state support for Merck will help ensure that physicians and patients like the one you just heard from have access to critical training opportunities as we go into the future. Now, you know, investing in our workforce isn't, I don't think it's optional. As someone who's on the front lines and does primary care, you look at the shortages that they're projecting. I mean, 2015, the United States is projected to have a $60,000 physician shortage in primary care. If nothing changes by 2025, we could be short by about 60,000 providers of high-quality, cost-effective health care. It's something we have to change. Especially when you think about the aging population of Minnesota, you think about the new people added to the rolls that are going to be getting health care through the exchange and health care reform. This needs to, at the very least, be supported and hopefully expanded in the future. So once again, thank you so much for supporting Merck funding. And I wanted to just take a second to personally thank Senator Franzen. You know, your efforts in support of the international and refugee physicians in the state are much appreciated in SF 1481. I had the privilege of directing a program that was initiated through the state in 2010 that allowed us to take residents that were trained from the Somali, Bhutanese, and Cuban communities in Minnesota, give them 7 months of clinical training, and help them apply to residency. We've gotten five physicians back into training in some of Minnesota's most needed underserved communities. And I just want to stress that programs like this are not possible unless Merck funding is strong and adequate for the needs of the state. Without Merck, I cannot do any innovation in how we train doctors for the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Michelson.
And I'd be happy to answer questions.
Members, any questions? Thank you again for your testimony. I think that we have a few more testifiers, if I'm not mistaken. Thought I saw. We'll get up. Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I didn't prepare any testimony, but I just had been listening to the comments and thought I would make a comment as well. And I think that when we look at the shortage...
Please state your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Twyla Bray, Citizens Council for Health Freedom. I think that when we look at the shortage of practitioners coming forward, particularly with the 30 million additional people to be added through the ACA, I think what we're talking about really are we going to give doctors a reason? Are we going to give students a reason to become doctors? And are we going to give doctors a reason to stay as doctors? And the doctors that I talk to, the doctors that I read about are really talking about leaving the practice of medicine because of the bureaucracy, because of all the reporting, because of the pay for performance, because of the low reimbursement rates, because of all the tracking that's happening. And so, you know, we can talk about increasing the funding for medical education, but if we really don't increase the reasons why anybody should want to become a doctor or stay a doctor, then we really have not succeeded. We will not be able to pour enough money in to make them even come through the doors. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brassi. Any questions from members? Thank you. There are no more testifiers at this time. Senator Lowry, would you move to lay this over? And
sure. I'd move that Senate File 1034, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. As that does conclude all of the segments of the bill. We've spent many days going over piece by piece, and so that would be my motion.
Actually, vote on. We just lay it over. We do.
We can just lay it over because actually, this is the vehicle that's going to be for the delete everything. So it really exists on its own anyway. But it's all good.
It's all good.
Thank you, Senator Lowry.
Senate File 471, Senator Hayden. Yeah, we, in order to, you know, as a heads up to members of the public and members, we're going to need to be jumping around on the agenda today to accommodate members where, you know, the general approach is going to be if members not on this committee come in and they're all in different hearings as well throughout the Capitol, as they come in, we're going to try to accommodate them, try to move members on this committee down the agenda, hoping that it encourages them to stay and listen to all of the additional bills. But sometimes we need to jump around and make sure that we accommodate everyone's needs. With that, Senator Hayden, Senate File 471.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This Senate File 471 is the Nurse Standards of Care Act. This bill represented hours of conversations. Many of you know and have been involved between the Minnesota Nurses Association and the Minnesota Hospital Association and other stakeholders. This bill, as of today, does have the sign-off of the Minnesota Hospital Association, the Minnesota Nurse Association, though I'm trying to round them up to see if they're around just to see if they want to testify as well. But we have worked together on this issue. Essentially, the bill asks hospitals to publicly report their own core staffing plan and make quarterly updates if they plan changes. The bill also asks the Commissioner of Health to study the correlation between nurse staffing levels and patient outcomes. We've requested that the results be made available to the chairs and ranking minority members in January 2015. We didn't make specific recommendations on what data the commissioner should collect since we feel he or she are the best experts to look at it. I do believe that there's a fiscal note that has provided some detail on the information that the commissioner would likely collect, and I know that we're still kind of looking at that. There is a companion that is running in the House that has a slightly different language, but both bills are pretty close, and so we are working closely with them to figure out what the final bill will look like. But we do know that both organizations are, you know, I would like to say somewhat comfortable with the bills, though we're still working out some of the study, some of the particulars in the study. I know that the fiscal note has come out and has given some specificity to that from the Department of Health. I guess what I'd like to say as a preemptive strike is that there may be still a little indigestion with it, but you know, my feeling is that we've given the department a pretty strong sense of collecting, of going out and trying to figure out a study that will allow us to, you know, once and for all try to try to understand what is going on in the marketplace there. I know that, and I'm hoping, and I'm very, very hopeful, because the folks that have been working on this bill, meaning the stakeholders, have been working very diligently to figure out how to get this to kind of fruition. And so I am very, very optimistic and hopeful that we will, that the Department of Health will get the stakeholders together and find a report that actually they can get the data and then come back and report to us next year. So with that, Mr. Chair, I stand for questions, and I know we may have testifiers from the stakeholders that might want to talk a little more about this.
Let's ask for questions of members. Seeing none, anyone from the audience wish to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 471? Ms. Krinke, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I do agree with the way Senator Hayden presented the bill, and that the Minnesota Hospital Association has agreed to the terms of Senate File 471, as well as the House Companion. And as Senator Hayden said, there's a little bit of language difference, but the two bills are nearly identical. We do, however, have some significant concerns with the fiscal note, which I know is a little strange to have differences of opinion and opposition to a fiscal note, but the fiscal note calls for the Minnesota Department of Health to collect significantly more data, potentially, than what we agreed to in the terms of the bill. And let me be clear here. The Hospital Association agreed to report our staffing plans on a publicly available website, and then to do a quarterly settle-up of how we actually did staff. So we have agreed to report our staffing levels. The study language that has the study, the fiscal note study, calls for, and it specifically says that data would be sufficiently granular to allow the calculation of average patient acuity levels per unit and shift, or patient-specific acuity level per shift. Now, it really is important to understand this. We have over 600,000 patients a year at Minnesota hospitals, and acuity levels, the acuity of a patient can change hourly. This represents potentially an enormous demand and burden on hospitals to have to report to the Department of Health patient-specific acuity levels. That is a lot of burden on hospitals, and something that we did not agree to in the course of the negotiations of this bill. Patient-specific acuity levels is a lot of information. I would like to challenge the department to look at the data on quality that we are already currently reporting. We have the provider peer grouping project that has been underway for a couple years now, with the reports becoming online. Number two, we have a whole information reporting system known as SQRMS, the State Quality Reporting Measurement System. Hospitals already report 66 quality measures to the Department of Health. And one thing interesting you could do in a study, you could look at those 66 quality measures that are already publicly reported and look at staffing levels and see how they compare. So there's a lot of information that could be done in a meaningful study without enormous amount of data, new burden reporting. So I caution the Department of Health, please do not add an enormous amount of new data reporting to our hospitals because of this study language. Let's look at what data is already publicly available first. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Any other testimony from the audience? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Andrea Ledger. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association, here to testify in support of this bill today. As many of you know, and as the chair alluded to, this bill has come a long way this session. And obviously, we started with an objective this year of hoping that the legislature would look at rather patient nurse levels and set a minimum standard. We were very responsive, though, to the concerns of legislators, which is that we need Minnesota-specific research on this particular issue. It's not enough to look at data from other states. And so that's how we came to the place where we are today, which is that the Department of Health will do a study about the relationship between nurse staffing levels and patient outcomes. To the subject that Ms. Krenke raised regarding patient acuity, one of the things that has been particularly difficult in terms of legislators' understanding of this issue, I think, has been where is the local flexibility as it pertains to nurse patient staffing levels. And it really is that issue of patient acuity that is necessary in terms of creating flexibility. What you'll find is that some patients are far more serious than other patients and require a different number of nurses. So we would really encourage any study that moves forward looking at the relationship between nurse staffing levels and nurse staffing levels and patient outcomes really take into account patient acuity, because a patient is not a patient is not a patient, as most of the literature demonstrates. So our main objective at this point would be that a comprehensive study is completed. We certainly still have issues with some of the legislation, but we've come to this place through listening to the public, and trying to be responsive to those concerns, and hoping to move forward with something that gets us good, solid Minnesota-specific data.
Thank you, Ms. Ledger. Any questions of members? Anyone else from the audience wish to testify either in support or in opposition? Seeing none, Senator Hayden.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. This has been a long journey, and we're getting closer. And I would hope that we can move this for possible inclusion. Oh, well, actually, I'm not sure what we're doing with this, Mr. Chair. Maybe I can get some advice.
It's in second reading in the House, so, I mean, we could let this go and track the costs.
Yeah.
I think Senator Franson had a question.
I have a couple questions. Hopefully they're quick. One, Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Hayden, did I understand correctly that some of the patient acuity information is already available in some form that's already – Ms. Krenke might have that answer, and I have another question for Ms. Krenke, actually.
Ms. Krenke, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Franson, we report – quality measures that have been identified working with the Department of Health, working with Stratus Health. There is a SQIRMS work group, and they add measures that hospitals are required to report. Currently, there are 66 different measures of quality that we have to publicly report. It is not patient-specific, and those are I don't know if I'm answering your question. It's not patient-specific, but we do have to report quality measures to the Department of Health currently.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Krenke, so the issue with the fiscal note is that it requires it to be patient-specific.
Ms. Krenke.
The problem with the fiscal note, Mr. Chair and Senator Franson, is it calls for a lot more data reporting than we had agreed to in the context of this being an agreed-upon bill. So going back to what House Senator Hayden introduced it, we have agreed to the terms of the bill itself. But then when we saw the fiscal note on the study was much more burdensome to hospitals than what we had agreed to.
And, Mr. Chair, Ms. Krenke, does that change your support of the bill? The association still supports the bill, or are you neutral at this point then?
What, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, what we would really like is a commitment from the bill's author and this committee to provide stern words and guidance to the Department of Health that this study does not get beyond the legislative intent. And also, quite frankly, the House bill calls for a work group. Let the work group work out the details of the study. The Hospital Association will be on the work group. The Nurses Association will be on the work group. Let that study group, work group, let them work out how the study should look rather than the Department of Health already predetermining how much data and reporting they want from the Minnesota Hospital Association.
Thank you.
Looks like Ms. Ledger's back would like to offer some additional insights.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Franzen. The SCORMS data is not related to patient acuity. The SCORMS data is about outcomes. It's data that is already publicly available. In addition, it's our understanding that the Department of Health doesn't think that that data is adequate because it's not by shift. It doesn't include the date of when the outcomes actually happened or the staffing level. So I think that the department is in need of more granular data, as stated. With regard to the working group, that's not language that's in the Senate bill right now.
Senator Hayden.
I know that there are some, I know that Mr. Koppel from the department and some of his staff is here. Maybe it would be helpful if they, since we're kind of hovering around the fiscal note, maybe it'd be helpful if they testify.
Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to say something in comments to what Senator Franzen said. Currently, we thought the Minnesota Hospital Association agreed to this legislation. This continued discussion about data being related to per shift, this agreement maybe is more tenuous than I thought.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask just a process question. Fiscal notes are considered part of the legislative record. Is that an accurate understanding?
I mean, they're publicly available. I don't know. I mean, the legislative record, I don't know exactly what that is. Senator Benson, I'm not.
Mr. Chair, sometimes when there's a dispute over the author's intent, they'll go back to what was spoken in testimony. And I presume that fiscal notes would be part of the testimony. And so the assumptions would be then considered part of the testimony as to the intent of this body when we pass this bill out. Is that a correct assumption?
I don't know what venue you'd be talking about that being considered in. I mean, I think the fiscal note is before us and does have some weight. And so I think that Senator Hayden's suggestion that we bring the Department of Health up and give some insights into the construction of the fiscal note could be helpful in this process.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'll just go straight to an example so that perhaps I can help clarify why I'm concerned about this level of detail. If we pass this bill out and one of the parties in a tenuous agreement says, no, the bill language says this level, and then the other party in a tenuous agreement says, oh, but part of the testimony was granular data to allow calculation of patient acuity per unit level and shift or patient specific, then we have a dispute over what the department is supposed to do. And because the department drafted this, the table tilts toward the department drafted fiscal note and not towards the legislation on its face. And that is my concern about the level of detail in the fiscal note, so that when there's a dispute in the future over what is acknowledged as a tenuous agreement, this may carry more weight than the face of the legislation. And that's why I really feel we need to get this clarified.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
I am going to hope that the department comes up, but let me just say this. There is two tracks. There is a bill in the House that has some work group provisions in it. There is a little bit of a difference in the bill that we have here. Our intention is to hopefully keep this relationship together, move these, and then there's opportunity once again yet on the floors to talk about it. And there's also some opportunities if the bills pass and are different to have a conversation in conference committee. So we do have some steps. I am concerned that we that we still continue to go down a path and hopefully arrive at a place. I think both parties still want to work together to get the best possible report that we can. So I just want to overlay that onto the process that we've been working. And then I'd also like the department to talk a little bit about how they arrived at the fiscal.
Mr. Rydrick, Mr. Koppel, who wishes to start?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me?
Mr. Koppel, welcome to the committee.
Introductory remarks. Jim Koppel, I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Department of Health, and Dan Radrick is our Division Director for Health Policy, and will be overseeing the study. I just want to clarify, I appreciate Senator Benson's comments, because I think the key to this study and to our fiscal note is the clarity in the policy that says we are to bring back a comprehensive study which will show relationship can be determined. And if we are going to do that, and if that's the expectation, then there are certain data that we will need to collect. So I think it's really important to be consistent, that our fiscal note in the policy and the bill are consistent. And the expectation of the Senate and this committee is consistent with what we propose to do. I think the issue has arisen because it's a tenuous agreement. We put forward what we think we need to do a high-quality study to bring back clarity. That pushes the envelope a little bit further than the policy language does, but that's what the implementation of the policy language would be. So I would turn over to Ms. Rydrick, who can clarify some of the details of what's in that fiscal note. But I just wanted the committee to understand that that's how we determined and how we went about determining our fiscal note, was in order to do the type of study that we feel is high quality and consistent with our reputation. Thank you.
Ms. Rydrick.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I should say, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that you're one of the few people who pronounces my last name correctly, despite its total lack of vowels, so that's always refreshing. So, again, for the record, my name is Diane Rydrick. I'm the director of the Division of Health Policy at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm happy to speak to some of the assumptions in our fiscal note, but wanted to echo what Mr. Koppel said, which is, our assumption whenever we have study language proposed to us is that the intent of the legislature is that we come back with something that is high quality and that really helps to further the discussion and answer the question that is posed to us. Sometimes we have a lot of detail in the language that's passed that sort of makes those assumptions for us about what's expected and helps us understand how we can meet the intentions of the legislature, and sometimes there's a little bit less meat to the language. In this case, again, we assume that what the legislature wants is a study that really will help to answer the question about, is there a relationship between nurse staffing and outcomes in Minnesota? There are different ways to answer that question. You can look at just sort of a general literature study, what's happened in other states. That's certainly a possible route, but we don't feel like that really helps to further the discussion here in Minnesota. This is a discussion we've had for a number of years, and we feel we want to be able to use some of the actual evidence to move that forward. So when we laid out our fiscal note, we noted the areas where we didn't have a lot of information in the bill as it stands right now, and where we would need to make those assumptions to ensure that the data that's coming in from hospitals is consistent and is based on certain standards. So if you have units defined in different ways, acuity defined in different ways, shifts defined in different ways, it's really hard to do any sort of comparisons across those facilities and come up with something meaningful on the other end. So that's really the heart of what's in the fiscal note. What's in the language right now does require the hospital association to publish actual direct patient care hours per patient and unit for each hospital on a quarterly basis. We considered whether that would be sufficient to allow us to draw any correlation, but when we thought about what that would actually look like, you would have some sort of an aggregate number for a whole quarter by unit in a hospital. And then, as Ms. Krinke correctly noted, we have data from the well-named SQRM system, the statewide quality reporting and measurement system. That would just tell you how many of a certain incident happened in a hospital in a year. So you would have information about number of falls, number of patients whose diabetes was managed, et cetera, in a year. Then you'd have this aggregate information by quarter for a hospital, and there wouldn't really be a way to tie those two together. So our assumption was, again, if the intent of the legislature is to have something that really helps to drive that conversation forward, we'd need to have something more granular in order to do that. I think that it's a fair point to say that there needs to be consultation with stakeholders throughout that process, whether that's through a formal work group,
whether that's through informal consultations, however that happens, there needs to be that community conversation around how do you define acuity, how do you define units, what are the outcomes that we're looking at. And that's an assumption in our fiscal note as well, that we would be having those conversations and working with the community to come to some consensus on that. And that would include acuity as well. It could be some sort of a general measure of acuity at a shift level or a unit level, because acuity does change pretty regularly. But again, we assume that there would be that discussion, that stakeholder engagement process to come to some standard definitions. But fundamentally, we need a certain level of granularity in the data if the intent really is to draw, to determine whether there's a correlation between staffing and outcomes.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, we've worked a lot on this bill, all parties, at least in both bodies in particular. I can speak to the Senate. And so there is an absolute commitment, as we have up to this point, to have all stakeholders, especially the two major stakeholders of this bill, to be involved in helping to determine what that would be. And so I think that clearly the department has said that they need to be in consultation with them. There is some language in the House bill that kind of memorializes that, and that I know that it is our intent to make sure that parties are involved there. You're going to have to go to these hospitals and other places to get the data. We need to ensure that the department can get it. I know that the nurses have been clear about the information that they think is helpful to figure out what's happening. And I know the hospitals have also said that they want to be able to do that as well. So there is an intent by me, the author, in a very stern way, I think. So. Well, that's what Ms. Krinke said. I don't know if anybody believes that. To ensure that we're getting this information and that we make a report back to the legislature as best as we possibly can to try to get at this issue that we've been looking at for a number of years here in the legislature.
Okay, we have comments from a few members. Four now, and in the interest of time, we really do need to be considering this bill and voting on it rather quickly. So, if we can be brief, Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Hayden. I am all for data integrity, and I think that's what you've been working on. It sounds like 600,000 patients a year in Minnesota. It's a lot of people. It's a lot of data. So, my only common suggestion. I'm not a research expert. But if you can get a significant sample of those without having that heavy burden on hospitals, and if there can be a compromise on a sample, just throwing that out there for the record, because I am concerned of the implications of having folks pick up information versus spending the time caring for a patient. So the burden on hospitals is a concern, but I'm sure you're going to take that into account.
Yeah, well, thank you, Senator Franzen. I appreciate that. I'm not an expert on how to collect the stat either, and that's what I think that the department is, and that they're going to work with the stakeholders to make sure that they can do it in the best possible way.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to step back in history a little bit. This started out as nurse staffing ratios. And the parties at the table, the hospital said, we don't want to go down that path. The hospitals want to manage their own care. They want to work with their staff and focus on their patients and not have all the decisions made in St. Paul. So Stephanie did it. And pressure came to the table, and Senator Hayden sat alone at the policy committee table and said, we have agreement. And now we have a fiscal note that, while not on its face, certainly in its structure, allows the department to have all the nurse staffing ratio information. So I think the hospitals are being polite in saying they're resistant to the amount of work they're going to have to do. But in fact, we're getting to the intended goal through this fiscal note, the original goal of tracking nurse staffing ratios.
Senator Benson, the original goal was to actually mandate the level of staffing that would occur.
Right.
This is a study. It is very different than the bill as introduced.
But we're creating a tool that makes it so much easier to go down a path that one of the stakeholders clearly doesn't see as valid.
Mr.
And
Chair.
So I think we need to be careful that this is not just a study and we can't just move on and sort of be okay.
there's a lot more going on here, and this has been a contentious issue for years and years and years and years. And there are a lot of people who just aren't okay with sort of getting there. So,
Senator Hayden.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate Senator Benson's take on it, as I always do. I disagree that this is any assertion that somehow this is just a backdoor way in order to get to ratios. And if that's not what Senator Benson alluded to, that's kind of how I took it. But some way to kind of get us closer to ratios is absolutely not what my intention is. Let me just be really clear, and I've been clear with all parties involved and you guys, that the idea is great patient care and protecting the people who do it and making sure that the hospitals can continue to work and operate to give to make sure that that care is given. That has been kind of the principles of what we've been trying to do here, and we are just, as in any agreement, I think that the parties have been doing very well at getting there, but at a certain point, the Department of Health, and I will say that I probably didn't engage the Department of Health as early in this process, or as early as I probably should have, just because there were a lot of things that were moving. But as they got involved, we were asking them, as the experts in collecting data and helping the legislature sort this out, to do that work. And I think that they have honestly come to the table trying to look at the legislation as it was before them in both bodies, and to try to come up with a solution that says that, to try to predict what we're looking for in this study, and to try to figure out how to gather the data. The moving forward is that we still have, and this, if you guys so choose, if this body so chooses to pass this bill, we still have the Senate and House floor yet to go. And if the bills don't line up, we possibly have a conference committee. And trust me, I am talking to the parties every single day, and have been this whole legislative session. So there's been a tremendous amount of work and a lot of goodwill. And if there is a bump in the road along the way, I think we can work our way through it. But there is no intent to somehow create a tool that then mandates hospitals in terms of their ratios of nurses to patients.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hayden, in the fiscal note, it references patient data a few times. I'm just curious, is this bill going to judiciary for all the data that's going to be required in this study?
Well, thank you, Senator Brown. I think the department can talk about how they're going to collect that data.
Ms. Roderick.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we would not be collecting patient-level data as a part of this study. The assumption is that hospitals would be submitting data to an extent based on recommendations that we get from stakeholders, because the language says that we would make recommendations for how data would be collected, but we would envision that it would be sort of a per-unit, per-shift, not patient-level data. I think the challenge is on the acuity level, how do you find a way to indicate that at a shift or a unit basis? But again, we would not be collecting patient-specific information.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, on page 3 of the fiscal note, under item 4, it says, and patient data as necessary as determined by the work group for use in determining blah, blah, blah. To me, that sounds like you will be collecting patient data.
Ms. Roderick.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown. Number 4 on the fiscal note refers to data that the hospitals would be providing to MHA. We assume that that could include, again, shift-level information, nurse and nurse staffing information, so number of FTEs to patient, some measure of acuity. We don't envision that that would include patient-level data. So if we've written the fiscal note in such a way that that implies that, we can certainly correct it, but we don't assume that there would be any patient-specific information collected.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Senator Rosen,
I think it would be very important to bring up the Hospital Association to make sure that the data that is transmitted or brought over to the department does not include this. So we need some verification from the hospitals.
Mr. Chair, if I may, to that point, on page 2, item number 2, in the last sentence, it says patient-specific acuity level per shift. If there's one person in an ICU, you now have individually identified patient acuity, patient data, individually identified that can easily be re-identified. And so while the department wants good data for research, I understand that. we also need to be very aware of how much hospital data is going to be transferred, and what it's going to look like and what it's going to be used for. And this is getting more and more concerning. I was pretty okay when we left policy committee that there was some sort of peace in the valley, even if people were uncomfortable. I am getting less and less comfortable with this bill.
And
Ms. Rydrick, to the point of page 2, item 2, is there going to be an ability to reconstruct who an individual patient is under any circumstance on what you're anticipating collecting?
Mr. Chair, no, there would not be. We assume that the patient acuity indicator, which again would have to be developed in consultation with stakeholders or a work group, would just be an indicator of essentially how sick a patient is. It would not be specific information about that patient. It would not be linked to any identifying information about a patient. And we assume that if there were a case where on a unit, on a shift, there were only one patient, as we always do with a study, you suppress information where there are small numbers. So, again, there would not be patient-specific information.
Mm-hmm. Senator Sharon was next.
Oh, I thought I said Ms. Krinke was going to respond to Senator Rosen's.
Ms. Krinke on this point.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm sorry that everyone thought this was going to be smooth sailing today. But when you read the fiscal note, it is almost like they are rewriting the bill that we had agreed to. And that causes us grave concern. There was discussion on the House side, and they specifically took out the per-shift language, and now the per-shift language appears in the study. So I think that the study language itself, we have grave concerns with. And so I don't know, moving forward, if the best approach is, do you split the bill and move the bill forward and then have your committee work on the study language? I'm not sure. The House bill does call for a stakeholder group. And obviously, I'm a lobbyist, and I'm over here at the Capitol. We have patient safety people at the Minnesota Hospital Association. We have data people at the Minnesota Hospital Association. They work on this stuff all the time. And that's the group of people that should be at the stakeholder table deciding and looking at what data can we get easily. So I would prefer for the study language to just say that the stakeholders will come together and that they will work on what type of data is easily given, what is easily reported. I think we need to kind of put some parameters around the study to let the stakeholders, which we will be at the table, as will the Minnesota Nurses Association. Maybe we should write that in, that the two key stakeholder groups will work on what data might be easily and readily available or something.
I appreciate Ms. Krinke reiterating what she said earlier, but the question to Ms. Krinke from Senator Rosen was how the data was transmitted or how you envision the data to be transmitted to the Department of Health. I just wanted to be sure that we answered the question that Senator Rosen asked.
Ms. Krinke?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, I'm not quite sure how to answer that question because we haven't agreed to give that data. So it's not in, it's in the study. It is not in the bill.
Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I know that we need to move forward on this. So I think we ought to take a vote on it. I want to reiterate a number of things that other people have said. It started out as a racial bill, which would have defined the number of people who were to work under certain circumstances, including acuity, and that has gone by the wayside. There is a concern I've heard here that if there is a study done that actually gathers data in a way that answers the critical question for the nurses, and that information demonstrates a relationship between problems of patient safety and staffing levels, that it will lead to a ratio. But that is a fear, because I think the consistency of the message from the legislature is a lack of interest in that kind of direction. Now, the nurses may have a continued interest in that, and I'm a nurse, and I've consistently communicated that it is not the method of establishing a ratio to solve the problem they believe exists is not going to be the methodology that they're going to find support for. There may be other There may be other approaches to deal with it, but it isn't going to be defining in law ratios. So we've got to set that aside. We have to quit talking about that. I'm asking the Nurses Association to quit talking about that. I can't control that. But we need to take a look at how to answer the question. So when the nurses have moved away from ratios, which they have, and have said we want to be able to get the study put together in a way that answers the question, and if it can be modified in a way similar to what Senator Franzen suggests, or others who are experts in research, that is a sampling that gives us a fair and reasonable answer to the question, then let's do that. But we aren't going to deep six this now, I hope, because people are starting to get anxious again. People are starting to get anxious. And I think we need to move this forward. And when you get to conference committee, except I don't know if I want to tell conference committee what to do, but if there's a work study language that we can incorporate into this to make it work better, then let's do that. But this has been a hard road with people giving lots of things up to get here for us to start to try to take it down right now.
Senator Sharon, I really appreciate your comments. I think we really do need to act on this bill, and if people aren't if members aren't comfortable, they're probably going to have to vote against it. We've had long, long conversations about this. We have a long agenda ahead of us. There is a commitment to keep working on this. What's going to happen is, you know, that if this moves, I'd like it to move separate, and I will commit to trying to accommodate it in our budget and track it in our budget. But I want that number to be small in my budget, in our budget, because we have very, very difficult targets to meet. I know several members still have issues they'd like to discuss, but we really do need to move on. I'm going to allow members to say a few additional comments about what they are, but we're going to need to have a vote on this bill in the next few minutes. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, a little bit ago I asked what I thought was a fairly simple question. I'm not trying to deep six anything. I simply asked, is this bill going to go to judiciary? With the amount of talk we have with patient data, I would think this would be a discussion for judiciary at least to have in their committee. And I asked what should have been a simple question. Is this going to judiciary? And I would also like a roll call on this bill.
Senator Brown, you did ask that question. And the question was answered that it is not intended to go to judiciary. We had a long discussion about whether there was actual patient-level identifiable data collected, and the answer to that question was no, which removed in our, you know, and maybe you disagree, but we'll see in a minute whether, you know, what the rest of the members feel. It is not the intent to send this to judiciary. If you believe that's wrong, you are able to make a Rule 21 motion when it gets to the Senate floor. You will get an opportunity to say where you thought it should go. That's the way the process works. Any other
comments? Mr. Chair, if I missed that, I apologize, but all I heard was, no, we don't believe about the data, but I did not hear anyone say this is not going to judiciary.
Well, now you have.
Yes, I have, and I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
I mean, you can make a motion that it go to judiciary. Any other comments of members before we act on this bill? Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, well, I just have to say something. I'm a little baffled. I first want to thank Senator Hayden for his work. I mean, I don't know why you took this bill on. Frankly, this has been a really, really tough situation. And I believe Senator Brown's got a very valid point. I believe that this study, especially the last sentence, where the commissioner, if it determines that more specific data is needed, can ask for this to they can ask for whatever they want, and I'm a little concerned about that. We are again changing the rules, changing the boundaries for a small group of nurses, and we have spent a tremendous amount of time on this, and I will be voting no.
I'd like to vote.
Roll call has been requested. A roll call will be granted. Any last comments? Senator Kiffmeyer, you were on the list. Would you like to?
Mr. Chairman, it's been well covered. Other comments have expressed my concerns, and that's sufficient for today.
Thank you. The clerk will take the roll. On the motion, which hasn't even been expressed. Senator Hayden moves that Senate
well,
file
Mr. Chair,
471.
I move that 471 be moved to the Senate floor.
To the Committee on Finance.
Or the Committee on Finance. Or is that?
We can't send bills to the floor, Senator Hayden. We're a,
well, then to the
we're
committee
a division
on finance.
Of the Committee of Finance.
Well,
so.
That's where I'd like for it to go.
Mr. Chair, this is not going to be rolled in either because of the fiscal note?
We're going to allow this to – the House has this on the floor already. We're going to allow this to travel separately. We're going to be watching it carefully. You know, some of our members will – you know, if it is acted on, be watching it, and we will track these costs in the on the spreadsheet.
So, Mr. Chair, we will be voting for a bill on the floor that has a fiscal note? That is completely – out of the norm. All the rules ever have always been in an omnibus finance bill.
Senator Rosen, it is not completely out of the norm. We have allowed bills to travel that have costs outside of our budget and tracked the costs. I mean, we have MFIP savings tracked in our bill that the language is in another bill. We are going to have potentially Department of Corrections costs that are tracked in another bill. We do allow language at times to one of the issues behind my willingness to let this go is that I don't want to be in a situation where this level of acrimony ties up our omnibus bill. I want this to continue. I want the stakeholder group to continue. I think Senator Hayden has done a good job, and of trying to work with both parties, and I have faith that he will continue to do that. I see clearly that there is still some issues to be worked out, and I'm going to be encouraging strongly both parties to sit down and make sure that we have a good study that brings back accurate results to be able to answer this question once and for all. This is not a new issue before the legislature. It is one that we have battled many, many times, and I think this is best served if we allow it to travel on its own and decide whether or not to track the costs.
Mr. Chair, Senator you know Rosen. I have a tremendous amount of respect for you, but this is a really, really out of this is a very egregious move, I believe. And there was a deal that was made when this bill came to policy. Then all of a sudden the deal was done. And we keep moving the goal lines here. The deal keeps changing. And now, actually, this bill really should go to judiciary. And it should – there are so many shoulds. And it's – we're giving this bill a lot of leeway for, what, 17,000, 19,000 nurses out of 90,000? I'm just appalled that we are allowing this to move forward like this.
Senator Sharon.
Well, there could be a number of things we could do to move this along. First of all, I need to respond to Senator Rosen's comment about the small group of nurses. This is really relating to inpatient situations. And when you're talking about the number of nurses that are represented, this organization represents what you might describe in relationship to all nurses as a small number, but the number they represent are those that are working in the circumstances that are being reflected in this bill. And that number is substantially smaller and gets smaller, which is one of the issues that this group is talking about, are concerned about, that is, it gets smaller, it affects patient safety. So it doesn't. The numbers aren't reflected. The total number of nurses who work in public health, community-based hospitals, in-home nursing visits, we cannot take that number of nurses and then say this association that addresses the nurses, the membership is the nurses who are trying to address this issue. That's number one. Number two, let's have a vote on whether or not this goes to judiciary. I don't agree that it needs to go to judiciary, so we can vote on that right now and get that off the table if people are want to do that, or vote against the bill. Or the third thing is let's just get the motion on the table and have a vote and see where it goes.
You know, I need to correct one of my earlier statements and inconsistency in the two as I think about it. We can't make a motion to send it to judiciary. All we can do is make a motion to send it to finance. We're a division of finance. We're going to have a recommendation. And so all we can do is send it to finance or defeat it. With that clarification. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm one of the few members of the legislature that doesn't have a hospital in my district. But all of the hospitals around me sat down and said, I'd like you to meet our nurse manager. And I met with the nurses. And they said, this is how we work. And it works well. The nurses and the nurse manager said it works well. They don't want decisions made in St. Paul. The path that we're on is a path that one of the parties doesn't even see a need to venture into. And now we're moving further and further down that path unnecessarily. We are aiming to solve a problem that I haven't seen evidence really exists. We have good hospitals. We have good patient care. And that's why the hospitals are resisting, and that's why you're going to get a lot of no votes on this.
That's fine.
Because hospitals
we'll get the
have
no
a good
votes.
System.
We've had extensive testimony here and in policy committee. Senator Reakin, final words?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just very quickly wanted to make it clear I don't think that we should be basing our vote on a fear of how this information might be used. I think that just gathering information could be helpful in a variety of different ways and could be used in a variety of different ways. So, again, I think that gathering information, I think this could be very useful for just for hospitals to use on their own. And we shouldn't, again, be basing it on a fear of what might happen.
The clerk will take the roll.
Senator Benson.
No.
Senator Brown.
No.
Senator Carlson.
Yes.
Senator Claussen.
Yes.
Senator Eakin.
Yes.
Senator Franzen.
Yes.
Senator Hayden.
Yes.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
No.
Senator Lori.
Yes.
Senator Rosen.
No.
Senator Sharon.
Yes.
There being 7 in favor and 4 opposed, the motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Sundrum, are you still able to stick with us long enough to take up Senate File 461?
7.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Sundrum.
Go ahead. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My hope is that this is a less complex bill, and I think it probably is. This bill, members, is about, and I'll be very, very short, project called Remembering with Dignity. It's something I've personally been involved with, as well as others, for a number of years. It has to do, for those that might be new, the replacement, if you will, of coffee can numbered monuments at state hospital cemeteries with a more appropriate and dignified grave marker. The bill is for $1 million in terms of bonding proceeds. We've done this a number of years. If you note this particular document here that you have, we've got in the neighborhood of 7,100 of these monuments restored, 750 in process, with about 5,000 left. So this is a work in progress, and we're simply moving towards the finalization of this effort.
Thank you, Senator Sundrum. I've carried this bill with you several years now, and I'm really always glad to be making progress towards this goal. I look forward to the day when we can finally have every single one of these graves marked and remember with dignity each and every one of those that lived in our state hospitals through time.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple witnesses. Not sure we haven't orchestrated this, but
okay. If they could be brief, that would help us a great deal.
Yes, I can. My name is Hallie O'Felvey, and I'm the community organizer for Remembering with Dignity. And here are two railroad ties that have numbers stamped on them. These were used at Willmar State Hospital. 500 people were buried with these. I could pass them around so you could feel them. They're heavy. And 167 and 38. So because of the way that the medical community was was at the time, people were buried with numbers because of shame. And we are right now we're working on Faribault State Hospital, and we will be working on Fergus Falls next year. And with this appropriation, we would complete 7 more cemeteries. We do a lot of public awareness with this. Self-advocates are involved. Self-advocates started this coalition, started this group, and we also use art exhibitions to tell stories. And people call quite often now because of the internet, and mostly the stories are, I have an uncle or an aunt or a grandma or a grandpa, and here's their name. And we were told that they were buried in the state hospital, that sometimes they don't even know what state hospital, and they say, I don't have much of a story. And I tell them, that is your story. And then I look and find, and as I talk to people, the story does get bigger. And this is about the people who are still alive, who have had this tremendous loss in their lives of a person. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cardenas?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this appropriation would move us a number of years down. We've been coming to this committee over the past 16 years. 1997 was the first appropriation that we got through Health and Human Services. We've now thought it much more appropriate to go to bonding through bonding, which is easier and doesn't take funds out of Health and Human Services directly. So I would just like to say that over the years, it has become well-known, but also not so well-known. And it surprises me that many people have never heard of it and are always always astounded at the idea that individuals would be buried with a number versus their name. Many cultures and religions, if you pass and you have no name, you don't pass. You stay there. You're stuck in a spot. Not that I say this is going to happen, but we sure want to make sure that it doesn't happen. So I want to thank the committee again, and hopefully we can move this forward. And we, luckily this time, the governor has become aware of it and has also put it in his bill.
Excellent. Yes, we hate to take any chances with the ever after. So with that, any other comments of members? Senator Sanders.
Mr. Chair, and you all know this. I'm involved in, you don't know this. I just maybe a little bit of a, you know, if you will, a confession. But my mother spent time in a Rochester State Hospital. I was there. I saw this. Now, she had a loving, caring family, and she wasn't going to be buried this way for sure. But many of these people in those days, if you will, were given up by their family by, frankly, a lack of understanding of mental illness and, frankly, an inability to really treat it. And so they were left to die in these state hospitals, and the remains were, in many cases, buried on the grounds with monuments like this. And so I just think it's almost a morally right kind of thing to do to give a little dignity to these people and these families.
I agree. Thank you very much for bringing this forward, Senator Sundrum. Senator Rosen?
I would just like to move the bill, or put it move to put it on a recommendation.
Yeah, remember the motion. It'll come back to me in a minute
right.
Here. But laid on the table, the motion, Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 461 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the letter to the Capital Investment Committee for our recommendations for bonding issuance, something like that.
Sounds good.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak either in support or opposition to Senate File 461? Seeing none, on Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you very
Thank
much,
you
Senator Sundrum. Senator Hoffman. Senate File... Where are we here? 762, under my paper clip.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good to see you again. Welcome back.
I have in front of you, though, I do want an offer, the author's amendment. It's A2. If somebody could please move that.
I'll move it.
Hold on here. Is this the first you've heard this committee, Senator, this bill?
It's first in policy and passed, and now moved to finance. So it's
okay. Well, that's not. It's not an author's amendment then that gets no discussion. I mean, that's the rules. So let me try to get caught up here. 762. I'm sure we'll get your amendment passed, but. Is the amendment being distributed? And the looks like the fiscal note is drafted to this A2 amendment. Is that correct, Senator Hoffman?
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct, although I want to point out one thing on the fiscal note. The table, it's starting in the actual 80% starts at July 1st, 2014, so you just need to move that box over. 2014, there should be zero. 2015, then it's the $3 million. So
okay, is that,
and that meet that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that meets with the language that's in the amendment as well as the language that's in the bill itself.
So the fiscal note is not properly drafted to this A2 amendment? Is that yes. What you're suggesting?
No, Mr. Chair, it is properly drafted. It's just that the table, if you look at it, the effective date is July 1st, 2014. And so when you look at the table on the fiscal note, that this should be almost missing one little box. It should be zero in 2014.
Well, then it's not properly drafted to the amendment. It would be, I mean, if we have the wrong numbers in 2014, we need to get that clarified with the Department of Human Services.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's consistent with the language in the amendment and the language that's in the bill description.
There's a mistake.
It's just a mistake. It's a typo on here, that's all.
Right, that's fine. I just need to get the folks who drafted it to come up and confirm that. That's is there somebody from the Department of Human Services that can speak to that?
So the total is going to be different here. It's the increase is effective in 14. Say fiscal 14, that would work. It's 14. So these columns are there.
They just need to shift. Correct. Zero the first year. There's no less of a financial.
You know, if you need a little bit of time to confirm that that's the case, go ahead and take it, and we can take testimony on the A2 amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The A2 amendment, this Senate File 762 really is in regards to, under the ACA, there was a group of individuals that were left out when we looked at the federal poverty rate in when we ramped up from 75 to 138% under MA, there was still a group, elderly and people with disabilities were left out of the mix. They still had a spend down. And that is under the new income standards, under the ACA, the MAGI, which puts it up at 133%, plus the 5% disregard at 138, or $1,278. However, and this is important because elderly and disabled must do still a spend down. So if they make $1 over 100%, they have to spend down to 75%. And what that does is that requirement leaves thousands of people over the age of 65 and those under 65 with disabilities with only 75% of the FPG to live on, which is $699. So it was overlooked on the federal level, and, you know, we're going to fix it. So I think that's an opportunity. And the fix, folks, this is what the amendment talks about. The fix is pretty expensive, and so what we've provided for you is, beginning in 1.12, is then effective July 1st, we go to 80%, so we just ramp it up, which is 1 minute. July 1st, 2014.
Yes.
That's what I said.
Sorry.
July 1st, 2014, we started 80%, and then the following year we go to 90%, and finally at 100%. Which the costing, the Department of Human Services will show you, does fit these numbers as well. Also, 1.16, we talk about delete everything after recommendations, and then this helps work through the increase to asset limit. It's a reasonable amount considering the changes since a limit was established for individuals and homeowners. So it's just explaining the ramp up. Finally down, waivers, and then it's just some language changes, but it gets the bill clean and neat and actually helps folks that are the most vulnerable in the state. So,
any questions of members on the A2 amendment? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hoffman, lines 12 through 14 on your amendment, are these the same criteria for everyone else with disabilities, or is this specifically for those 65 and older who have the spend-down requirement? I'm not real clear on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator and Senator Brown, thank you. Great question. It's for both. You got folks with disabilities under 65 and those that are 65 and older. And what we're seeing is that group was specifically left out in the federal ACA. Two things. Number one, they still had a spend down, which is, I think, discriminatory against the rest of the populations. And number two, they have a $3,000 asset limit. And so we're going to address the asset limit later, but we really wanted to try to put steps in place to correct that spend down issue that is not consistent with how everybody else is underneath the ACA. So,
and Mr. Chair,
Senator Brown,
Senator Hoffman. So I'm just trying to understand, do we have a different set of criteria for this group of people than what everybody else has?
Yes.
Yes.
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, the answer is yes.
And is it Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, is it this group of people that are, I don't know for a better word, are they taking a bigger hit than the other group?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, yes.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, why wouldn't we put the same language, make them equal, instead of having discriminatory language like this? Why wouldn't we create a bill that would make them equal with what everybody else would receive?
Senator, Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, that's exactly what we had when we went to policy. We had it, but the fiscal impact, knowing where we're at financially, we went back to the table and said, let's ramp this up so that eventually it becomes fair. And so that's what you're looking at. That's why we went with the 80, 90, and 100%. I would love, Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, I'm with you. I would love to see us fix it right now, but...
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, you're saying we can't
Senator
afford
Brown.
It right now? Is that what I'm hearing?
Senator Hoffman,
talk about a ramp up. I don't understand why we have to ramp up. Why don't we just do it? It sounds like we can't afford it right now. Is that accurate?
It's very expensive.
Senator Hoffman.
Yeah, Senator Brown, Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Brown. It's a great question. You know, when you look at it from the whole list, the whole point, we did not get a fiscal note, but we know it's going to be very expensive. So that's why we went back and said, what would it cost each year? And that's what the table gives us, the $3 million, then the $10 million, then the $17 million, then the $18 million. Finally, you know, you're at $19, $20 million a year to help fix this gap.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman,
Senator Brown.
This legislation is saying we don't want to spend the whole kahuna right away.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Brown, it's saying it would put other programs that we need to fix as well. I think it would start to pit one against the other, and this way it gives a common sense approach to get us where we need to be. The outcome is still there. They need to be treated exactly like everybody else is being treated. This just gets us there in incremental steps.
Senator Hoffman, did you have testimony?
Senator, Mr. Chair and Senators, I do. I have Ann Henry from the Disability Law Center here with me, and hopefully she'll touch on the other two points of this bill that's important as well. So when we promise to be brief.
Yes. Ms. Henry, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Disability Law Center at Legal Aid. This is a long issue, and we have been trying to make progress on it for a while. We really would like to do it all right now, but given the budget targets, we wanted at least to have on record a commitment from the legislature to get to equity for this group. The second part of the bill requires the commissioner to make recommendations on how to deal with the asset limit, which is also an unfairness. You do have a chart somewhere in the pile of paper in front of you, and it really tells the whole story about all the groups on Medicaid and what their income limits are and their asset requirements. We know that we, as a matter of state policy now, expect people with disabilities and seniors to live in their homes in the community. Allowing them only $3,000 of savings to manage to do that simply doesn't allow people to fix their roof or buy new appliances. So consistent, we have to change it. And finally, the third provision requires the commissioner to request federal authority to stay where we are, treating people with disabilities who are married in a way that makes sense for the under 65 instead of having to shift to a different policy. So we ask for your support. Thank you. And you did get Heidi Myrie would have testified, but given the weather, she's not here. But here's her statement. She's a bit over the 100% of poverty, so she has to spend down every month. And if you look at the picture, a lot of you will recognize her. She does come to the Capitol and advocate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
I have Katie from DHS who wants to come and explain that little exactly what happened.
Great.
And then I have one thing to add just to with the Ann Henry, and then I'll be done.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Katie Knutson. I'm with the Department of Human Services. We have reviewed the amendment along with the fiscal note, and we do acknowledge our error. The table should be shifted. Fiscal year 14 should be zero. The numbers then should all shift to the right. So what is currently at fiscal year 14 should be labeled as fiscal year 15, and we apologize.
No, that's just fine. These are everybody's working hard to make sure we have proper information, and we need to make sure we have it on the record of testimony. So thank you very much for your quick work to clear that up. Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just on the last point of Ann Henry, it's called spousal impoverishment, where what we're asking for is a waiver to say, folks, you don't have to get divorced in order to keep getting benefits from the government. And it's just bad. And it's good that we're taking care of that. So
great.
Thank you.
Let's move the A2 amendment quickly. Senator Eakin moves the A2 amendment. I think we understand it now. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hoffman's goals are laudable. It appears we're moving out of conformity with the ACA. So let's just acknowledge that we're moving out of conformity, but there's also an asset test that we're not working on. Is that correct, Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chair Senator Benson, absolutely. I think the nobody else has an asset limitation except this group, and I believe that's wrong. And so we're asking the folks that understand this better than probably any of us in this room to go ahead and look at why that's happening, number one. Number two, recommendation of what would be if there's any need for asset, because that's a slight overlook from the federal level, and they basically left it up to states to fix it, and so we are here fixing that. So,
but I think we're not out of compliance with the ACA. I mean, if members of the disability community fit under the MAGI standard and they wish to, purchase insurance products through the exchange, they're able to. There is another, historic route to benefits and services, including health care, through a disability method that was not covered by the ACA, and so we are not moving out of compliance with the ACA. I think that's an important point to keep straight. Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hoffman, I just a vote for this bill is a vote to continue to prolong discrimination. We're creating two classes of disabled people here. Those who are going to be get one set of benefits, and then this group that's going to get less than benefits. It prolongs it. So for me to vote for this bill is a vote to just prolong that discrimination. The fact is, if we changed our targets for HHS, we could cover this and help these people in an equal and non-discriminatory manner the way the others are being helped. So we could do it if we wanted to. We're choosing not to, and that makes it very difficult for me to vote for this bill when I'm picking winners and losers and some prolonging discrimination against some people.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I love your advocacy. I wish I could be there with you. This is good common sense steps, because if this gets defeated, then we're telling people you have to spend down to 75%. You can continually live in poverty. And so this is a common sense stepped approach to fixing this problem. And I think a vote yes creates a win-win within the disability community.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Any further comments, questions from members? Seeing none, anyone in the audience care to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 762? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 762, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much.
Senator Latz, I believe, is still here with Senate File 7, number 15 on the agenda. It'll probably be a little deeper in members' packets. Senator Latz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File Number 7 provides for expanded background studies for those who would be appointed, licensed as guardians and conservators in Minnesota. As you can imagine, guardians and conservators play a very significant role in taking care of persons that can no longer take care of themselves, or for one other reason can't take care of themselves. They are usually appointed by a court. They have access to their financial records, to all sorts of financial accounts, check writing abilities. They also have physical access to persons who are in many ways quite vulnerable. There have been a few instances of inappropriate conduct by guardians. A most notable one that has spurred the Attorney General's office to bring this bill forward involved very substantial financial fraud, essentially theft, from a person that could not even recognize that it was happening. So the conclusion for that situation was that we needed to do a better job of providing background data to the courts when they make that decision to appoint a guardian or conservator. There was a fiscal note associated with expanding that background study because it would expand the study to include all databases that reflect fiduciary duties, among other things. So any person that has been in a position of having a fiduciary duty, if they were at any point licensed to do that, and in particular if they had any marks or licensing actions taken against them relating to those duties, we want to know about that. In particular, the judges want to know about that before they appoint the guardians and conservators. Commissioner of Commerce or the Commerce Department came to me expressing concern about how to handle the fiscal note, and we believe reached a way to handle this without expanding any costs. And that is related to the A3 amendment. I have Peter Brickwood with me from the Commerce Department to answer any questions.
We'll have the A3 amendment handed out.
Thank you. Essentially, what we do is we have the Department of Human Services conduct the background studies, regardless of which agency is maintaining the data. So, for example, if the application comes in for to be a guardian, and they're going to do the background study on databases that are maintained by the Department of Commerce through an interagency agreement, Single point person in DHS will have access to the electronic databases in the Department of Commerce to be able to conduct that background study. That will avoid any fiscal impact on the Department of Commerce, and the fee associated with the application to be a guardian is intended to cover the costs of doing that background study, so there should be no net effect or costs on any agency for doing what's required in this bill.
No general fund. I mean, there would be the fees would come into the special
correct
revenue and out, but they would balance out. Okay.
That's the idea.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
On the A3 amendment, we're going to try to move that
we'll
first.
We'll just do that first. No.
Okay.
I'll wait.
Senator Hayden moves the A3 amendment for Senator Latz. On that, Mr. Brickwoody, you are able to come and testify that this A3 amendment would take care of any costs associated with the Department of Commerce. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwoody, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. Senator Latz's description of the amendment is accurate, and really appreciate his willingness to work with us on that. The Department of Commerce, as many of you are familiar with, licenses over 350,000 individuals in the state of Minnesota across 70 different classes. And so relative to the requirement in this bill that Department of Human Services obtain licensure-related information for the background purposes of completing the background study required under the bill, we had quite a bit of exposure to this. A3 amendment would require DHS to enter into interagency agreements with agencies like Commerce who do maintain that data. And that would remove the, we believe, the bulk of our fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwoody. The A3 amendment addresses the Department of Commerce's concerns. Any further questions on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, on Senator Hayden's motion on the A3 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
DHS has some input as to whether the fees that are in the bill are sufficient to cover their costs relating to the additional responsibility that they will take on.
Mr. Kerber, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Human Services, which includes the licensing division where these background studies are done. I just want to clarify that the bill, as it had been drafted, as it had reached the committee today, had a fiscal note of zero for the department. The fees recovered our actual costs for doing the work. What the amendment does is it really more or less transfers the work, the labor that was going to be done by the Department of Commerce to the Department of Human Services. And so I guess what we would ask, Mr. Chair, is that we get a chance to renew our fiscal note, to take another look at it following the amendment, to figure out if the will of the legislature is that the fees totally recover the actual costs for doing these background studies. Then we would like to figure out what those costs will actually be for the department, and then propose a different fee for these studies.
Okay. And you, how quickly do you think you'll be able to complete that analysis?
Mr. Chair, I believe we could do it fairly quickly. There are a number of different agencies that we are going to be expected to contact. In order to keep the costs at a minimum for our agency, the bill language talked about that we would send an email to these agencies with the names of individuals and have those other agencies respond with information about that person's licensure history. That was going to be very cheap for us to implement. The amendment, it's not a bad way to change this, but what it does is it requires that we enter into data sharing agreements with the other agencies, the licensing agencies, so that we would have access to their databases ourselves so that we could look them up. The fiscal note that was prepared by the Department of Commerce showed that it would take the Department of Commerce 2 hours per person studied to look in their 5 different databases. So they had, a total of 9.8 FTEs to do that work. Under the amendment, that work shifts over to the Department of Human Services. So if we are to recover the cost for that, the fees would probably go up significantly.
Senator Latz. Is this new information to you?
It is, Mr. Chairman. While I still support the concept of setting the fees at a level to recover the costs so that there's no net fiscal impact on the general fund, apparently DHS can't give us a number right now to insert in the bill. I've got maybe an approximation, and I would be happy to either insert an approximation now, if it's the will of the committee, and to await a tighter revision of that number for later correction, or whatever your preference is.
Mr. Kerber, do you think you could get an approximation that would...
Mr. Chair, I think an approximation of, looking at the Department of Commerce's costs and dividing those by the number of studies that we do, I think it varies a little bit from year to year, but I think for the Department of Commerce part of this background check, the fees would need to be increased someplace around $65 a piece over the current 22 that are currently in the bill. 22 plus 65, Mr. Chair, is
87.
About $87, and that covers one agency. We can get much more precise, but if the other agencies are going to be handled similarly, I think we're probably closer to $100 per study on these individuals. And if that were to go in, we could certainly work on this and verify that or suggest a change in the next few days.
And Mr. Chairman, I would support that. I think the importance of properly screening out those who could be a threat to the physical or financial health of the people that they are guardians or conservators over is well worth the investigation and the background study. Once an appointment is made, this is often a long-term appointment, so I don't think people would be facing filing or fees on this every month. It'd be a long-term fee. So I think that would be perfectly reasonable, and I would support making that change. The only difference in the bill, I think it's line 1.25 and line 2.1 that set the fees. There's a difference for out-of-state, former out-of-state residents of $15. So I suspect that difference we could just maintain that ratio or that amount, the $15 difference in an amendment. So I guess I'd ask if we could amend the... if we could amend this on line 1.25, change $22 to $100. And on line 2.1, change 37 to 115. Mr. Kerber's nodding his head. Maybe he can say that for the record.
Mr. Chair, that would be the logical conclusion for this quick, very quick analysis.
I'm sorry, I just tried to move something. I don't have the jurisdiction to move. I'm sorry.
You suggested,
I request.
You suggested
I suggest.
That it be moved. Senator Claussen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you also have to take a look at line 1.22?
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair and Senator Claussen, that can stay the same. Those are a different type of background study that we're doing. These are more specific. In those $20 standard background studies, we're not doing this kind of record check. So that can remain untouched.
Thank you.
Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Latz, sounds like work is being shifted from the Department of Commerce to the Department of Human Services, and we're grossing up the fee, but I'm not seeing any reduced costs on the Department of Commerce side. I just want to make sure if we're going to amend these dollars. Mr. Berkwitty, perhaps Mr. Kerber can talk about how the hours of research are shifting from the Department of Commerce. I see 2 hours per request from the Department of Commerce. Will you still have to do 2 hours of work if you give HHS or the Department of Human Services access.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Senator Benson, the bill proposes to add new duties to the Department of Commerce. With the amendment, it will not be adding any new duties to the Department of Commerce, so there would be no impact.
That was the testimony. The effect of the bill was to transfer this work to the Department of Commerce. It wasn't specifically stated in the bill, but when it looked like the Department of Human Services was just going to expect all of this data to be accessible to them, the Department of Commerce, with that wide range of licensed activities, found that exposure. And so by transferring that back to the Department of Human Services, Mr. Brickwoody testified that it would bring the Department of Commerce costs to zero with the A3 amendment that we've already adopted.
Okay. Mr. Chair, then I'm confused because I thought the fees were in there to cover the Department of Commerce cost.
Senator Benson, the fees were there to cover the Department of Human Services costs.
Thank you.
And then again, it wasn't intended to create those costs in other departments, but it did, and that was flagged by the Department of Commerce. And they did some work to determine what the level of those costs were and said, you know, I mean, that's going to be tough to cover. So the amendment transfers that costs from Commerce, the Commerce costs, over to the Department of Human Services in addition to the Department of Human Services costs that they already had. And so then the fees need to be adjusted to accommodate that transfer back. Now, there is one additional general fund expenditure in here. There's $61,000 at the annually, $122,000 in the of costs in the Supreme Court, and I don't know that there isn't an amendment to transfer those costs yet. But if I heard correctly, I think Mr. Kerber said if other departments are to be treated in a similar manner as we just treated Commerce, the adjustment to the fees in the Department of Human Services would allow for that as well. Is that but then we'd need an amendment to treat the Supreme Court in a similar manner as we treated the Department of Commerce, if my understanding of the testimony is correct, and I'm trying to track here.
Mr. Chairman, my file is I left on a chair back there. I've got the Judiciary budget spreadsheet on it. My understanding, it would be very small, and I think either we'd ask them to absorb it or it's included in there, but I have to look at the spreadsheet to be able to verify.
You know, I should look at that spreadsheet and see if there's anything else we could.
Yeah. You're well taken care of on that budget. Rebecca?
Senator Latz has lost his folder with the spreadsheet.
Oh, there it is. Oh.
Kerber was hiding.
For members of the committee, I admit that I
told
had
me
his
it
file.
Was his.
We're taking care of it, protecting it.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I don't have it separately identified in the Judiciary Committee budget.
61,000 a year, according to the fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman, I will commit to the committee that if that cost continues forward, that I will find it in the Judiciary Committee budget to cover it. And we've got sufficient funds in our budget to be able to cover that.
Really? Sufficient. Really?
Wouldn't that be nice? Senator Benson.
$61,000 I can find.
That's per year.
Yes.
So it's 122 for the biennium,
right.
Just to make sure. Senator Benson?
And Mr. Chair, before Senator Lett so kindly offered to absorb the judicial branch did agree to absorb part of these costs already and brought it down to $61,000. But if he's agreeing to sign the money, I make no further protest.
Okay. I must admit I'm a little unclear as to the path that this language would need to take. So
is it going to stay here, or does it need to get to other committees in finance? Is it your intention, Senator Latch, that this be placed in our Health and Human Services omnibus bill?
As far as I'm aware, it does not need to go to any other finance division. I guess I'd prefer that it would travel on its own, but I'll leave that to the to the decision of the chair, however you want to handle your individual bills.
Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes, I have a question about the bill. Mr. Chairman, if you need to finish your train of thought first.
Well, I think we need a motion for the oral amendment as suggested by Senator Latch. Senator Rosen moves that on line 1.25, strike the 22 dollars and replace it with $100, and on line 2.1, strike the $37 and replace it with $115. Is that correct, Senator Latz?
Yes.
I think we've had a discussion on that. Any other further questions of members on that motion? Seeing none. On Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Sorry. As to the judiciary piece, I'm rereading the fiscal note in that section, I'm recalling my conversation with my fiscal staff on judiciary. What they propose is that they would need 0.70 FTE for an auditor, and that's where the $61,000 comes from. We did have a conversation with the Supreme Court, and we asked them what would happen if we didn't give them 0.7 of an auditor. And they said essentially they would absorb it and it might cause some little bit of a delay in getting to their auditing work in the course of the regular business, but that they could handle that without us supplementing their budget in any way. And so that's why it's not reflected in a line item in the judiciary budget, and there's no other language associated with that. It was my intent to have the court absorb that 0.70 aspect, auditor aspect.
Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Latz, my question is in regards to line 2.7, section 2, and the change from every 5 years to 2 years, plus the additional increase tremendously, three times, four times the fee as well, and especially when it's being renewed every 2 years. And so I know we're concerned about the court costs and the Department of Human Services and everybody else, but these are also costs that typically also come from the person under guardianship or in other cases even from the state having to pay these fees if they are the not if they are the guardian, but if they hire somebody to do these functions. So I just want to be concerned that those who pay these fees, especially a significant cost increase here, and maybe, Senator Latz, you could address who is it that pays these fees and how might this affect people with disabilities who are in a situation where they might have to compensate guardians or conservators for these costs.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to take a stab at that, and if Deputy Attorney General Voigt has anything to add to it, I'll ask him to do that. Senator Kiffmeyer is right. The guardians, they get paid for their services, and I understand it, often that payment comes out of the funds of the person that they're taking care of. It seems to me, yes, it's a substantial increase in the fees and the application fee, and I recognize that. But to pay essentially $50 a year for a background study, $100 for every 2 years, for a background study, which is extensive and which will protect the individuals, it seems to me that's not an unreasonable amount in the scheme of things when essentially they're running a business as a guardian. Even if they're family members, they're still getting paid for their services. I would suggest it would have a de minimis impact on the assets of the person who is being guardian or conservator is responsible for the scheme of things. Benefit from doing this background study would far outweigh the minimal costs. It looks like a big increase, yes, but if you set that part aside and just look objectively at the actual cost itself, I would say the benefit of being able to conduct these background studies is well worth it.
Mr. Chairman, many family members do not charge to their person under guardianship because many times there are an allowable amount of about $68 a month for personal needs after SSI or other costs like that. So many family members do not pass that on to their wards. They absorb them, pay themselves personally, and you're exactly right. This is a tremendous value. It's just a simple financial thing. We're looking at the numbers for the court. We're looking at the cost that they have. We consider this as valuable. But I'm just saying that not only is it the first time upon appointment, but also a change every 5 years to 2 years. Not all do pass this on. Not all are in the business. And this is something that would, in many cases, come out of the pocket of the ward who are on a very, very low. I think we have a letter here from others as well on the kind of amounts that they do live on. So I just want to share that concern that sometimes it looks great to just say, well, we're just going to raise these fees and it is valuable. But somebody has to pay that fee, and I think that maybe to just give some consideration for those that do not have a large business, that there's a distinction between those two. There are also some wards who have substantial funds and can readily accomplish this and probably have a greater need because there's more larger amounts of money at stake as compared to those who are in a very de minimis situation. But I think this may be a real hardship on those family members who currently do not charge their wards and just provide this gratis.
Senator Lapps.
Mr. Chairman, I agree, Senator Kiffmeyer, with your concerns, and I wish there were an easier way to address this. I haven't heard your committee saying that you've got funds in your own division for the taxpayers to be able to pay for these background studies. And I'm not sure I'd be comfortable going with a with any kind of an income status to determine or income testing to determine the level of fees, since the amount of work for a background study is the same either way. And if you did that without digging into the general fund, you'd have to lower the fees for some. You'd have to raise the top fee for the others, depending on whatever your threshold is for the amount of assets. An awfully complicated system to administer would end up costing a whole lot more than this, because you'd add bureaucratic administrative costs to that. Every potential guardian that applied, you'd have to do some kind of an income screening to figure out if they fit into which category for the license fee or the fee amount. So it seems unworkable. I think the easier way to do it is just to pick a number and there'll be some that have a bit of a hardship over this, but I suspect if you ask the vulnerable people that are being taken care of, they would say, I'd rather make sure that whoever it is that's appointed to take watch over my assets hasn't been convicted of financial fraud last year. They'll lose a whole lot more than the $50 or $100 in the fraudulent theft from their assets than this fee.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want, this is not about the worthiness or the protection or anything like that. To just be clear, this is a finance committee, so I'm just trying to deal with everybody's finances that are being touched by this, not just state government or agencies. And probably the one thing is that there is a program run by the court that currently has financial details, tremendous amount of details already financially, total amount of money, also has records of whether a guardian currently takes compensation from a ward or does not. This is already entered into the court system. It is already there. As a matter of fact, this system is currently in the process of a rewrite being done by the court. And so I think there's probably more ease and availability to have an adjustment in regards to that than what maybe you might know about. But I just want to introduce that, and I think I want to be sure that all costs are made known here. Thank you.
Senator Latz, in reviewing this, reluctantly, we're going to have to keep this in our division. If we collect the special revenue funds, we have to appropriate them as well, and it would be fairly complicated for us to track this as it moves forward. And with this amendment, it appears we're adding 13 FTEs approximately to the Department of Human Services, and we really do need to track the FTEs we assign to the Department of Human Services carefully as well. And so we're going to try to keep this here. And in addition, in the House, it is in the Finance Committee as well, which means that that is their intention also. So were we to let this go, you wouldn't have a House file to match up to as you moved forward.
Okay. Whatever path works better for the committee, I'm just fine with. Until Representative Hillstrom? Yes, Representative Hillstrom is carrying it apparently in her judiciary budget bill. Is what I'm told. So I'm not sure where it'll best match up, but maybe you wish to hold on to it, include it in yours, and if we need to do some swapping at some point down the road to match it up, we'll figure that out procedurally.
Okay. Well, maybe then what we will do to be we'll dual track it the way we do for things so that it's on our table and moving separately, and it'll go to the Finance Committee, and if it needs to go to a different Finance Committee, Senator Cohen can take care of that and get it to a different Finance Committee. If it needs to stay here, it will already be here. But with this amendment, I don't know what the House did the House adopt this amendment as well?
I think they're working on it. They were moving.
Public Safety Committee is going to be determining whether DHS needs 13 more FTEs.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwood from the Department of Commerce. I noticed simply just because I happened to sit in the hearing this morning, Representative Hillstrom did put the identical amendment onto her judiciary omnibus bill in the House this morning.
What about the fees?
Mr. Chairman, I do not believe they adjusted the fee in the amendment.
You do believe they did?
Mr. Chairman, no, I believe they did not. They just did what is the A3 amendment that your committee just adopted.
Ooh, that would make me even more nervous if we put the Public Safety Committee allocating the actual general fund human services costs then. Is what it sounds like that would be. I mean, if we transfer the cost back to the Department of Human Services and don't raise the special revenue funds through fees to cover them, it would be a general fund cost. So we have some work to do
Mr.
on
Chairman,
this.
Mr. Chairman, I would resist any efforts on the part of the House to accomplish that. I would fight vigorously for the Senate position.
I would appreciate that very much. Any further comments of members? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Latz, just some clarification on line 1.24. I notice in the bill that we reference the BCA, the commissioner. On page 1, it doesn't specify which commissioner we're talking about. Can you just clarify that for me?
It's the Commissioner of Human Services.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, and Senator Latz, with the references to the BCA and new language on criminal history data and so forth, will this bill be going to the Public Safety Committee?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not see a reference to the BCA in new language.
Senator Brown, what is your reference that you're asking about?
I'm simply asking a yes or no question. With the BCA being mentioned in this bill and with new language being about criminal history, I'm just asking, will this bill be going to the Public Safety Committee?
Mr. Chairman, the answer is no, because there is no change to current law involving the BCA. That's why I asked my follow-up question, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Senator Latz.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I had to step out for a few minutes. So we are assuming the 13 FTEs in human services. And historically in the past, just help me step through this. Sometimes the public safety, public safety would be in health and human services budget. And then it would go out and then come back in. So are we assuming all of the public safety bills or judiciary bills?
No. Senator Rosen, what happened was the bill is drafted, covered human services costs to gain access to additional databases regarding licensed activities within the state of Minnesota. And DHS was, you know, identified with the cost to do that.
Right.
But then the Department of Commerce that oversees, you know, a wide breadth, I don't recall the number, but a lot of licensed activities in the state of Minnesota, their databases would need to be accessed in order to do this. And they flagged a fairly significant cost, you know, nine FTEs for the Department of Commerce to oversee the data provision for giving DHS access to those. And that was going to be $513,000 of general fund at the Department of Commerce. They flagged that and said that's, you know, that's going to be a problem, and came to us, and we adopted the A3 amendment, which said that that cost essentially will be transferred back to the Department of Human Services. And then Mr. Kerber said, well, if we're going to do that, you need to cover that cost as well with the fees. And we adjusted the fees with your motion to accommodate the extra cost that came over from the Department of Commerce. So it's a little bit of a trail here, but that's what's...
So we're still separating, Mr. Chair, some of the public safety, some of the...
Safety is not in our budget. No. And you know, honestly, I'm willing to dual-track this and watch it carefully, but I do believe that the right place for this, with its current construction, is here in our budget. And I'll say that on the record, but it's possible that, you know, another resolution that would remove my reservations may come along as this progresses. And so, you know, referring it to the Committee on Finance as well to allow that continued effort to go on, and it wouldn't have to come here for another hearing if some other mechanism were agreed upon. I'm comfortable with that dual-tracking motion, but it is my preference at this point with the status of the bill that it would be accommodated in our HHS omnibus bill. And you would need to help me a great deal when we got to the floor to...
Absolutely. And Mr. Chairman, there's a reason it's not in my judiciary budget bill either. And, you know, the House has those committees split up into a separate public safety committee and a judiciary committee. Representative Hilstrom chairs the Judiciary Committee there. But I can't – I spent enough years in the House to know I can't explain what they're doing to you now.
Okay, good. All right. With that, any further comments of members? Anyone from the public care to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File Number 7? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 7 – as amended, be recommended to pass and both referred to the Committee on Finance and laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman and members.
I'm just going to grab whatever file happens.
Yeah, come and grab some from back here, Senator Latz. We got all kinds of files. Senator Franzen.
Mr. Chair.
Senate File 1481.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that we stand before the committee lunch and these two bills that we're hopefully going to go quickly. The first one, Senate File 1481, you've already heard a little bit about the introduction earlier today. I'm not going to reiterate or repeat what was already said. I'm just going to add that the university distributes the funding that we're requesting for this bill, the $5.3 million, to the School of Dentistry, the Community University Healthcare Clinic in South Minneapolis, medical resident training at the University of Minnesota Physicians, the university training programs at the University of Minnesota Medical Center, and health education centers in Hibbing, Woolmer, Fergus Falls, Crookston, and North Minneapolis. So the funding does go far beyond the metro area, and it's very much needed be restored. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Terry Bach, Assistant Vice President of Academic Health Center at the University of Minnesota, to really delve into a little deeper the importance of this funding to be restored this fiscal year. Thank you.
Welcome Mr. Chairman to the committee. State your name for the record.
I'm Terry Bach. I'm Associate Vice President of the University's Academic Health Center, and that includes the University's six professional schools of medicine, nursing, pharmacy, dentistry, public health, and veterinary medicine. You heard earlier, MRC funds are very critical to the training not only of doctors but of nurses, pharmacists, and dentists. And while the main program is a critical one that that provides training funds to the hospitals and clinics and pharmacy and other care providers for our students, and we have almost 1,500 students and residents there. What the main program doesn't do is help us really focus on finding and training healthcare providers for rural and urban communities that are facing the greatest shortage of healthcare providers. So these funds allow us to do that. We have used the funds in several ways, we spend about $2.5 million in training of dental students, hygienists, and therapists in clinics in Wilmer and Hibbing and a number of underserved communities in the Twin Cities area. And we not only are trying to train people in a different kind of environment, we're trying to interest them to practice there. And we also, in fact, provide some important safety net services. So our 140 students annually who are learning their education and doing their training provide services to over 36,000 patients annually in those clinics. And 70% of those people are public program patients. We also provide funding to the Community University Healthcare Clinic, which is in South Minneapolis. It's a very unique clinic. It has a huge immigrant and refugee population. We actually provide medical and dental services in seven languages there. And we have over 400 of our students and residents who rotate through there for their training to be able to have an experience in dealing with a very poor multicultural refugee and immigrant population. And I'd say finally to talk a bit about the area health education centers. We have funds, which is part of a federal grant that we have. We have regional offices in Hibbing, Wilmer, Fergus Falls, Crookston, Rochester, and in North Minneapolis. The idea is to serve the entire population. And the idea here is severalfold. One is we have programs to interest high school students as well as college students in health careers. And what we have learned is that our best chance of getting health providers to practice in underserved communities is that's where they came from, and they want to go back. So we spend a lot of time trying to encourage people to be interested in a wide variety of healthcare services. The second thing that the AHEC centers do is actually provide clinical training sites. And instead of what happens in many parts where we send one medical student or one dentist or one nurse, we send cohorts of students to these community sites. They're taught by community practitioners, and they are learning new cares, new models of care, which are interdisciplinary and interteam, exactly what we need to do in this new healthcare environment.
Thank you, Mr. Bach. Senator Franzen, further testimony?
Mr. Chair, I do not have any further testimony. You've heard some other testifiers earlier today as well supporting this bill, so I don't have anyone else unless anybody
is
present here.
Any questions of members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience care to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 1481? Seeing none, Senator Franzen moves that Senate File 1481 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Franzen.
Would you like to try to get one more done, Senator Franzen?
We can accomplish that, Mr. Chair. The next bill is Senate File 1562, and it is regarding an appropriation for the Minnesota Poison Information Centers. And I can say firsthand, this past summer, knocking on doors, I got bit by a dog and realized that I wasn't sure if the dog had its shots and whatnot, and made a call to my local clinic, and they said that the only place that had thought if I needed one would be HCMC and their poison center. And there I realized the value of this center. And this bill aims to appropriate $2.4 million for the poison information centers. It is a core regional center for our state to make sure that we have access to certain services that are not available anywhere else in the state. So with that, I also will have testifiers, Dr. Thomas Wyatt, who's a medicine, emergency medicine physician with Mercy Hospitals in Coon Rapids. He's also president-elect of the Minnesota chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, and Ms. Deborah Anderson, who's the director of the Poison Control Center.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. We've got your written testimony here. Dr. Wyatt, if you are able to make it brief, it would be greatly appreciated.
Sure. Mr. Welcome. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Dr. Thomas Wyatt, and I'm an emergency medicine physician. And I'm here to talk with you today about the critical importance of funding for the Minnesota Poison Information Center. As already mentioned, I'm a board-certified emergency medicine physician, and I practice emergency medicine at the Mercy Medical Center in Coon Rapids, Anoka County, for the last 10 years since my graduation from the emergency medicine residency at the Hennepin County Medical Center. I'm also the president-elect for the Minnesota chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, which represents over 500 emergency medicine physicians in our state. And I'm here today to urge you to support the Senate File 1562 legislation to appropriate $2.4 million for funding of the Minnesota Poison Information Centers. During my three-year emergency medicine residency at HCMC, I was fortunate to receive toxicology training from the Hennepin Regional Poison Center, which is located at HCMC. I continue to benefit from consultation with the Poison Center throughout my 10 years of practice at Mercy Medical Center. Poison Center is a critical resource for both physicians and patients in the community. Speaking from the perspective of my own hospital, which has a busy suburban emergency department that sees around 60,000 ED patients a year, we made 419 calls to the Poison Center alone in 2012, and a total of more than 1,900 calls over the last 5 years. Virtually every one of my 24 partners in the emergency department was able to recall the Poison Center, providing them with crucial information for the management of a patient. I worked an overnight shift just this past Monday night, during which my partner on duty and I each called the Poison Center and received pertinent information about drug ingestions affecting our patients. I'd like to point out that if our busy suburban emergency department is contacting the Poison Center this frequently, and the more rural emergency rooms and critical access hospitals across the state are undoubtedly finding major benefit from the expertise and assistance of the staff at the Poison Center. If I may, I'd like to give you a few examples of cases that have stood out in the minds of my partners. Imagine a 2-year-old girl who spilled an old rust cleaning product containing hydrofluoric acid on her face, neck, and arms, causing deep burns. The Poison Center gave instructions on how to compound the calcium gluconate gel that stops and treats this specific type of burn. Think about an elderly female with dementia who took a week's worth of beta blocker blood pressure medication, causing her blood pressure and pulse to plummet. She presented to our emergency department in shock, and the Poison Center was able to recommend life-saving therapies immediately, and she did quite well. Picture a 3-year-old child who accidentally swallowed commercial rat poison, also known as warfarin, which has the potential to cause life-threatening internal bleeding. The Poison Center directed therapy, and the child also did well. And finally, I think about a young adult male who, while intoxicated, attempted to drink what he termed a homemade Molotov cocktail. Luckily for him, his girlfriend brought in a list of ingredients used to concoct this Molotov cocktail, and the Poison Center was immediately contacted while the patient was being evaluated by one of my partners. Initially, the patient appeared to be fine, according to my partner, but the Poison Center staff recommended that his airway be secured. which entails a breathing tube being placed and having him put on a ventilator due to the caustic nature of one of the substances that he ingested. Within a matter of minutes, there was significant bleeding and secretions from his gastrointestinal tract, which could have compromised his airway and breathing. Because the poison center helped us to anticipate this development, we were able to treat the patient proactively, and he also did quite well. There are a number of stories like this in both the suburban, the urban, and the rural communities in our state. Of equal importance is the role the poison center plays in surveillance of illicit recreational drugs that have become very popular lately, the so-called bath salts, also known as 2CI or K2. No other service compiles a database of these overdoses, and the vast experience gained by cataloging these overdoses allows the poison center to monitor abuse of these drugs and make recommendations for treatment of the potentially adverse effects. Poison center also plays an important role in alleviating emergency department overcrowding and reducing medical costs. Only the patients that need medical care are referred to the hospital. As your fact sheet indicates that was distributed to you, the poison center safely manages 92% of poisonings at home. And research has shown that every $1 invested in poison centers saves $13 in medical costs and lost productivity. I'd also like to bring to the committee's attention the letter of support that we have from Dr. William Hegard, who is the current president of the Minnesota chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, which represents over 500 emergency medicine physicians in our state. Minnesota ASEP is in full support of funding for Minnesota Poison Information Centers. In summary, I'd like to say that we rely heavily on the expertise and assistance of the Poison Center, and any disruption to the operations of the Poison Center would amount to a public safety issue, as we are all potentially one accident away from needing their expertise. Thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wyatt.
Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Anderson will just stand for questions if any members have any questions, because I believe we had a presentation earlier in
we
the
did.
Session.
We did. Any other questions of members? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Wyatt, I was just wondering if your opinion, if you feel the current funding for the center is sufficient.
Dr. Wyatt.
I would have to defer that question to Debbie Anderson, who's the director of the poison.
Ms. Center. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, current funding is not sufficient. We are currently running in the red, if you will. Over the last 2 years, there's been a federal grant cut of 36%. Our current federal grant is in continuing resolution and will be sequestered, along with static state funding. So our state funding from the general fund has not been increased since it was instituted, and I believe that was in 2001 or 2002. We've downsized to make funding work, and over the last 2 years, HCMC has had to come up with extra cash to put into the program. So last year, about $650,000 HCMC provided to keep the service for the state afloat.
And Mr. Senator Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Anderson. What would happen if HCMC could not continue to pay that $600,000?
Ms. Anderson.
And why is the federal grant being cut by 36%? This is a priority for the feds.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, that's a great question. If we don't receive funding, calls are either going to be picked up late, delayed answering. They may not be answered at all. We need to look at whether we can provide 24-hour service in that emergency call center. We will lose national accreditation, which also makes us eligible for those federal funds. Even though they're declining, it's over $200,000. It's very helpful. So all of these pieces together kind of network and impact the whole situation.
And
Senator Rosen.
And Mr. Chair, I know it smells really good in this place, but Ms. Anderson, you service the entire state, is that correct? HCMC services the entire state.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, yes, we do. HCMC is contracted by the Minnesota Department of Health to provide this service. Every year an RFP goes out, we respond. We have had this contract for quite a while. So people look at it as HCMC's poison center. It's truly the state's poison center that HCMC is the vendor of. And yes, we do provide service to the entire state of Minnesota, public and healthcare professionals.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions of members? Senator Carlson. Or Clausen.
Sorry. Senator Franson, was that a terrier that bit you? Because I think the same dog bit me, perhaps.
Senator Clausen, I have no idea what kind of dog bit me. But what I was told by some of HCMC staff is that most dogs in Minnesota or in the United States are rabies free, if you will. So I wasn't frothing it at the mouth, so I didn't go and take the shot. I heard it's a pretty tedious process to get the rabies shot, so I deferred from doing that.
We both know that campaigning can be a dangerous adventure. So.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
The question I have is also on financially. So of the total amount of money that it does take to run the Poison Control Center contracted with through DOH, what is the percentage from Hennepin, percentage from the state, percentage from the federal? It seems like those are the three.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, the state general fund right now is 47% of our budget. The federal HRSA funding, along with some emergency preparedness funding, makes up about 15%. And then the rest of it, the remainder, 37-38%, is HCMC.
And, Mr. Chairman, if this bill does pass, there's a third, so there's a lack of 5% cut coming from the Fed approximately. By funding this from the state level, does that help to make up that 5%? Does it add at all to your actual budget, considering the federal government poor choice of priorities here in cutting poison control centers 36%? So is the funding, if this were to pass from the state, the additional funding going to help make up for the feds, or on top of that, add to you as well?
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, the funding that's requested will help fill that deficit of the federal grant, yes, and also allows us to replace a couple lost positions that we've have taken over the last couple years as we have downsized the program. And that will allow us to maintain our national accreditation. Those accreditation standards were just changed in February, and we are not quite meeting them. And like I said, to be eligible for the federal funding, we need to maintain that accreditation.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
if this bill were to pass with this additional funding, then I get a sense of the feds, and that's great. And then HCMC, would they then continue to put in the additional approximate $600,000, or would they be able to not do that?
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, HCMC would not have to put in that amount of money and fund a statewide program.
Okay. Well, Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
So is that 37% with the $600,000 or without it?
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, that is with that 36%.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I believe that 36% or 37% is the $650,000 amount that we're talking about that HCMC had to put in because of the lack of state funding. So they were essentially forced to cover it.
Okay. All right. That's helped me. So
Kiffmeyer.
If this bill were to pass, we would add the 37 to the 47 and 5% from the feds. And so we'd end up with the state paying 90% and the feds paying 10% if this were to pass.
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, that is correct. The federal government currently pays 12% with our HRSA federal grant and another 3% with some emergency preparedness money. So the state would be at about 85%.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience care to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 1562? Seeing none, Senator Franzen moves that Senate File 1562 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Franzen. And with that, we are going to take a brief break. We're going to break till 12:30 approximately for a brief lunch. We are in recess.